The E-12 Education Finance Committee will come to order, and we're going to, excuse me, we're going to change the, we'll take up Senator Uyghur's 3001 bill that we've been working on last week, and then after that, Senator Bach's bill. Senator Uyghur, you want to, we have a number of things that we need to accomplish in the next couple days, and one of them is to work through the Senator Uyghur's bill and then the amendments that members may or may not have, and we'd like to address those today. And then tomorrow we'll have hopefully kind of sorted out all of the things that is that has occurred, and also put together a budget balancing package that that we hope to get passed through our committee and forward on to the Finance Committee. And the Finance Committee will be taking that the budget package up from the different divisions on Friday, I believe at 11 o'clock. And so we have a lot to go through. I want to, I know there aren't a lot of members here yet, but I want to, and I'll probably remind them again when more members come, but we do have that letter that we sent out cautioning members that we are very fiscally tight with a $935 million deficit, and that it's a supposed to be a short session, not a full-fledged session like last year or next year, which, by the way, is only about 7 months away. So anyway, we'll get started and try to get through everything and be accommodating to those that want to testify on some of the provisions. So, Senator Uyghur.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, at the last meeting, I presented the bill and would now stand for questions.
Okay. Senator Uyghur there were a number of things that, well, each of us kind of tackled the bill from two different angles in terms of, in here you have a number of provisions that have fiscal impacts and a number of provisions that are policy related, and a number of provisions that are unfunded mandates. And I would invite, after, if members have amendments, to be free to offer their amendments, or if individuals and the public would want to testify on different parts of your bill, that would be fine too. So are there any amendments to Senator Uyghur's bill? Senator Rummel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I have Amendment A50.
Okay.
And since we last met, we went through the bill to try to get closer to what the department was asking for. And so you will see on page 30, lines, I believe they are, well, on the version I have, they're lines 30, 31, and 32. Okay. We're going to delete that paragraph. What I learned is that the department gets federal money to handle schools that don't meet AYP only if they're Title I. And so this was asking the department to do more than what they are currently obliged to do, and that was not our intention. And so we are omitting lines 30, 31, and 32.
Okay, we don't have a quorum yet, but why don't we just go through the... Oh, we do have a quorum. All right, let the record reflect that we do have a quorum. Why don't you just go through your amendment then, Senator Rummel, and then we'll make the adjustments in the bill.
We are also deleting lines 16 through 22, and that refers to... page 62, that's the student engagement item in our report card plan. And after much discussion over the last 4 days, it just seems prudent to get a little bit more consensus on what that might look like. And so at this time, I'm going to take that off the bill. And then finally on page 61,
31. No, she
also has page 20. Page 61, we are deleting all of section 53. Page 62, we are deleting all of section 54.
So, Senator Rummel, sections 53 and 54
right.
on page 61 and 62 are deleted.
And then I'll have to ask Ms. McQuay to explain why we made changes on... I'm going back to page 31. I'm sorry. I'm not doing this in a very sequential order, folks. I'm sorry to be... why we were changing the word determinations on line 1 points... I'm sorry, in line 14 on page 31.
Mr. Chair and members,
Ms. McQuay,
the changes on page 31 deal with the changes to an effective date. When we delete on page 30 lines 16 to 22, those are the changes that the effective date deals with, so we don't need those effective dates anymore.
Thank you. I knew there'd be a good reason. So those are those. That's the amendment.
So on page 31, line... after the period on line 11.
Mr. Chair, members, beginning with subdivision 3, paragraph D on line 11, and that goes through all the way through page 31, line 14, determinations, so that entire sentence.
Maybe, would you, Ms. Quid, would you go through the rest of the those provisions?
Mr. Chair, the on line 7 of the amendment, line 22 of the 3001, there's a provision in the report card that asks that school safety and student engagement under the paragraph that we just deleted also be included in the report card, so that student engagement indicator needs to be taken out. So beginning on line 22, everything after safety, and then on line 23 up through paragraph D is also deleted.
Okay.
And then on page 61, section 53 is a work group that was going to look into developing a model to project anticipated performance on high school preparation. Senator Rummel wanted to keep the rigorous coursework in the report card as just a list and remove the task force that would look into a model. And so that's what is taken out of section 53.
Okay. All right.
And then Section 54 is the task force dealing with the student engagement indicator. And that's no longer needed.
Okay. Any questions on any members? And what we had a fiscal note earlier. Mr. Melman?
Mr. Chairman, actually, we've been working off of a completed House fiscal note. The Senate fiscal note hasn't been completed, but I anticipate they'll come back virtually identical. What this amendment would do is take out virtually all the costs, save for $188,000 that would be remaining as a result of this amendment.
Okay. All right. On Senator Rummel's amendment, any other questions? Any comments? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Okay, Senator Saxhug.
Mr. Chair, the 845 amendment.
Okay, Senator Saxhug.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment is language dealing with the sections relating to PSEO and online learning. We've removed any language in the PSEO section that had any fiscal impacts, and mostly that deals with sections 30, 33, and 34. The A45 amendment clarifies the enrollment process, provides for communication between the enrolling district and the online provider, and creates consistency in the syllabus format. It also recognizes the shared responsibility of the enrolling district and the online provider for monitoring student progress and clarifies the review process for the Department of Education. If anybody has any questions, we worked, I think, with all the players, and we think that this is a good compromise. And I have John Voss from District 287 to answer any questions that may have.
Is it Mr. Voss?
Voss.
Mr. Voss? Mr. Voss, give your name for the record, please.
Jonathan Voss, Intermediate District 287, Supervisor of the Northern Star Online Program.
Okay. If you could want to share some comments on the amendment and what on the online learning provisions that are left in the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As Senator Saxhug mentioned, our efforts here are to make the procedures for enrollment clear and consistent and coherent, and to outline the responsibilities of the online providers and the enrolling districts so that the students and the districts are aware from the very beginning that the courses they're taking are going to meet their graduation plan, and also that there is support for the students from both the enrolling district and the online provider, and that the department review process is based on a consistent syllabus format and assurances that online programs meet nationally recognized professional standards for instruction and delivery.
Is there anyone here from the department that wants to comment? Ms. Clensing? morning. Please give your name for the record.
Good morning. Karen Klinzing, Assistant Commissioner, Minnesota Department of Education. And we have met with John Voss and been in discussions with Senator Saxhog and reviewed the language and do not have any concerns.
Okay. All right. Any other questions that members have? If not, Senator Saxhog renews his motion on the A45 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted.
Thank you.
Good work.
Thank you.
Any other, thank you, Mr. Voss. Any other amendments?
That whole time. Well,
can
I have A45, Mr. Chair?
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the A27 amendment.
Senator Scogin offers the
A27
amendment. For anyone that might be here for Senator Bach's Senate File 3076, we just got word that there is no fiscal note, or they have to have a new fiscal note, so he's not going to pursue that bill at this moment, or at today, so we won't be hearing Senate File 3076. Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A27 amendment deals with Section 28 and 29. It talks about transportation issues, gives us some heartburn in greater Minnesota, and that some of these smaller districts have very small fleets of transportation. Transportation directors already have a very good handle on the maintenance of these buses. They have drivers that have long-term employment with them. They understand that in some cases paying them by the route is better than paying them by the hour, but they are compensated in a fair manner. And a lot of it is repetitive language. I know Senator Olsen did a lot of work on making sure that our transportation system was safe. A lot of this is reporting and over-reporting in Section 28. And in Section 29, I'm just where a bus driver has the right of refusal, and if another bus isn't available. And out in greater Minnesota, on a cold winter morning, we have children waiting by the mailbox. And if there becomes an issue between a transportation director and a school bus driver on whether or not a bus is going out, it actually could be harmful to the students that are waiting. And I wouldn't say that Section 28 and 29 wouldn't have its day. I just don't think it's been vetted out very well. And at least for this year, I'd like the A27 to remove those two sections.
Hey, Senator Scogin moves that A27 amendment. Is there anyone that, any questions that committee members have? Anyone that wants to comment?
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Galen Lems with Minnesota School Bus Operators Association. I'm here to speak in favor of Senator Scogin's amendment to remove this language. A few things I'd like to say. Since last spring, I've attended various committee meetings that have dealt with this with Senator Dibble, and the SEIU have sponsored this legislation. In the past, they have implied that contracted school bus operations are less safe and in a lot of cases more expensive. It should be I'd like to refer to the SEIU study that they conducted. It points to St. Paul's, an example of expensive transportation. I'd like it to be noted that St. Paul historically has had the lowest per pupil cost unit of transportation over any other district in the state, and it is almost entirely contracted. The study claims that for the 2006-2007 school year, bids went up as much as 25% for certain routes, but the study quickly and without proof dismisses the possibility that it has anything to do with increased labor or fuel costs. Does not mention the 2007 engine requirements that increased bus prices by $6,000 per unit, or what the rising prices of metals have done to the school bus market. The study also forgets to mention that the bids for the 2006-2007 school year required contractors to provide drivers with paid sick leave, a provision according to the St. Paul Pioneer Press that was suggested and promoted by the SEIU, but was not mentioned in the study as a reason for increased transportation costs. One thing that we'd like to remember is that driving a school bus in the state of Minnesota is considered a part-time seasonal job and is funded that way by to the state by the local school districts. I'd also like to refer to the Elk River School District about cost efficiency. In 2004, the Elk River School District asked its contractor, Vision Transportation, to take over the 20 special needs buses that they operated with school-employed drivers and to take over all the duties of their transportation director and their staff. At the time, Vision Transportation was operating approximately 125 school buses in the Elk River District. In the very first year, they cut $800,000 out of their transportation costs and subsequently balanced the budget for the Elk River School District. This is a real-life example that district-operated managed transportation systems are not necessarily more efficient or cost-effective. Now, as I look over this bill, it makes me ask a couple of questions. What does this bill accomplish? We feel that it does not accomplish anything. It does not make student transportation any safer in Minnesota. Right now, the Department of Education is already working on a model contract and best practices guide as per the recommendation of the legislative auditor. We believe this is the best place for these requirements, not statute. And as we speak right now, they are meeting in Roseville with Bob Fisher from the Department of Education. Also, Senator Olsen has a bill going through committees that reestablishes the Office of Pupil Transportation Safety that could be possibly headed up by Sergeant Dwayne Bartles from the Minnesota State Patrol. Also in this bill, we'd like to point out that workers are already protected by state and federal law regarding the labor issues of being paid for time worked. And the right to refuse clause, which Senator Scogin talked about, this bill claims to be for safety, but it could potentially put children into harm's way because school bus drivers may not be familiar with Minnesota Rule 7470.0600. They may mistakenly believe that a bus is unsafe and in turn leave children out standing along the roadsides. So the next question is, who does this bill benefit? It doesn't benefit the school districts. It will, obtaining all this information will come at a price, whether it's funded or unfunded. This could be an unfunded mandate. I believe this bill invades my privacy as a private business. How I attract and retain quality workers is part of my success as a business and should not be shared with the general public or my competition. I feel this bill invades the privacy of my employees. Wage information, hiring dates, and their driving records should not be made public information. The only group this bill benefits, we believe, is the SEIU. This is sponsored by them. They will be able to obtain information such as the wages, hiring dates, and driving records of drivers that they have never been made public information before and that they have never been able to obtain. We believe this is a serious breach of confidentiality between me and my employees. With all due respect, this legislation, we believe, benefits one group. We strongly oppose it as the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association and ask that it does not go beyond this room today, and we ask and we support Senator Scogin's amendment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wenz. If you'd like to give your name for the record, please.
Yes, Kimberly Nelson. I'm the political director at SEIU Local 284, and I am speaking in opposition to the amendment.
Okay. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. SEIU will be the first one to admit that we do new member organizing. We do believe in a strong middle class, and we are out there organizing new workers. And we take a lot of pride in the fact that we do organize new workers. So let's just throw that out there on the table. SEIU is a labor union that does believe in growing the middle class by organizing new members. But let's talk about the main reasons and the bigger reasons that we're involved in the issue of student transportation. First and foremost, we are the largest exclusive representative of school bus drivers in the state. Our drivers believe that they are professionals in the job they do. They want to see standards maintained. They want to make sure that the standards within their industry are protected, and we would hope at some point the folks would start looking at how increasing standards within this industry actually will create for a stabler workforce and increased cost savings to our school districts. We are also a large representative. We represent 8,500 members, the vast portion of which are school employees in the food service industries, custodians, paraprofessionals, and clerical folks. You know, when we speak of unfunded mandates and we talk about how education dollars might be not being spent in the most efficient way, and we look at the area of student transportation, it's one of the top spending areas for our education. And our folks, our custodians and our food service drivers, our food service workers, are the first ones to get laid off when budgets are tight at the school districts. If those school levies don't pass, our custodians and food service workers are the first ones to go. So when we're looking at, you know, the cost of student transportation, we're looking at whether this bill is an unfunded mandate or not. SEIU takes a great, great interest in making sure that that's not the case, because we want to make sure our other folks are equally protected. What this bill does is it simply says we need to take a stronger look at how our public funds are being spent within our school districts. And we're asking that before school districts enter into a private contract, that they look at these types of things. We know that driver experience is the most important thing when it comes to accidents. And we would hope that our school districts are looking into, you know, that when we talk about school bus safety, it's not just about maintenance of the buses. Only 1-3% of accidents is due to maintenance issues. It's driver experience. Does this driver recognize the students on the bus? So what's the driver turnover rate? You know, do they know that Johnny has to be dropped off on this corner and not that corner? Do they understand the issues of bullying on the route? If they drive the same route continually all year long, they get to know the traffic patterns. They get to know what days the garbage picked up along this particular route. It does come down to the stability of the workforce and driver experience when we look at school bus safety issues. What SEIU is asking folks to do is something that I can guarantee you that if you ask your parents, every single one of them, or I would say at least 85-90% of them, excuse me, would say that they agree with. Before you spend my public funds, I want to know the quality of level of service that I'm going to get from this private contractor. SEIU, we would have loved to have gone farther in our school bus legislation. We proposed legislation last year. And the language you have before you is compromise language that we came up with the St. Paul School District, with the Minnesota Association of Pupil Transporters, and with the support of Minneapolis Public Schools. So we have done a lot of work on this. I would ask that you pass this through committee. It's been years that we've been talking about this, 5 or 6 years, and everybody says next year, let's keep studying, look at it next year, next year. SEIU will continue to work with the industry, with Senator Olsen. I want to thank Senator Wieger for all the work he did do in the interim on this issue. We'll continue to work with the Minnesota Department of Education and our school districts and parents on this issue. Thank you, and I'll stand for questions.
Senator Cook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I just mostly have comments about it. And a couple things. I'm on the Transportation Committee, and I have seen Senator Olsen's proposal. We are adding staff. We're creating a pupil transportation safety office. We're adding troopers to that staff. That is a tremendous effort towards safety. And I'd like, you know, if we're going to continue on a track, I think that's going to get us safety. As far as bang for the buck, I'm not sure what – I think that this requires – people's names and addresses, is that right? I'm not sure how that plays into knowing where my money goes as a taxpayer. And then thirdly, as a parent, about 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, there was a two-hour late start for Buffalo School District. My daughter is 12. She's in the sixth grade, and 2 hours late, she started off for the bus. It happened to be a late start for us here, thankfully, because I was getting dressed. About 45 minutes later, my daughter comes back in the room. And this was a two-hour late start, so the weather was incredibly inclement. She had just the bright pink cheeks. She had the ears turning white from the cold. And she had been at the bus stop, and for whatever reason, that bus did not show. And I said, babe, 45 minutes. I said, what were you thinking, waiting 45 minutes for that bus? And she said, well, I didn't want to miss it. And she's 12. Imagine a 7 or 8-year-old standing up. They'll just stand there. They're not going to miss the bus. And now, again, fortunately, I was home. I was able to take her to the bus. I thought about driving around the neighborhood and picking up all the other kids that had been left at the bus stop. But I do have concerns that this bill could cause more of that. I'm not sure who made that decision not to get out that day. Other buses were picking up other kids. I never did call the bus company. Kind of, I got here and got busy, and Rachel had made it to school. But it was of tremendous concern. And as I said, she's 12. She figured out after 45 minutes to come on home. You've got a 7 or 8 year old standing out, and I had no way of knowing that she was still waiting at that bus stop. I was just busily getting ready and going about my day. So, you know, that as a parent, I guess that's my biggest concern with this, and I support Senator Scogin's amendment.
Senator Scogin.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I just want to say that philosophically, SEIU and I are on the same page day after day, and the work they do for the organization of the middle class is wonderful work. Today, I'm thinking about Senate District 10 and those kids that are out in rural Minnesota in these small districts that only have 5, 6, 7 buses. They only have 1 or 2 spare buses, and there are days when they just need to get serviced. And I think the person in charge of those buses and the bus drivers have a working relationship that works where I live, and that's why I offer the A27.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's kind of interesting to hear Senator Cook's experience because I was thinking along the same lines, but I came to a different conclusion because my kids have had the exact same experience this year, that especially the first 2 months of school, and they're 8 and 10, they're a little bit younger, the bus didn't come. And they had drivers, this happened at least half a dozen times in the fall, that the driver would go get lost or take the wrong route or whatever it was. And a couple of times I found out when I got home that the bus never came. And luckily, my children know the neighbors. I live in a city neighborhood where there's a couple of neighbors where the kids go to the same school. And they know where to go. They know to find another mom. And they found their way to school. And they were fine. But it scared the heck out of me as well, because I had left and our house was locked up and they had no parent at home. I mean, my kids have a key, but anyway. I didn't want them going home alone. Obviously, they needed to get to school. But to me, when I was listening to what the SEIU witness was saying, it made me think, I want the drivers to be the best trained drivers that we possibly can have. I want drivers who are not going to change every week. That's what happened at the beginning of the school year. We had new drivers trying to learn this route through the city streets. You know, we have school choice in St. Paul, so kids go, we have it everywhere, of course, but in St. Paul, you go all over town. My kids go halfway across town to school, and so there's a really complex bus route. I want a driver who is committed to that job, who's well-trained, and is going to stay on that job. And we have one now, and I'm really thankful for it because it is an issue of peace of mind and safety for our children. So I think it's critical to have the best trained workforce driving our buses, and that's what I think this is for.
Senator Bonhoeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, too, support the bill as written and do not support the amendment. And, you know, there are so many of us parents sitting at this table, and I know that my he's now 17, but when my son, when he was 13, was unwilling to get on the bus, and we didn't, all of a sudden he kept saying he was sick, he couldn't go to school. And when we poked into it, it turned out that he thought his bus driver was very mean, and he kept yelling at the kids, and it came almost a situation where he literally made himself sick because he was afraid to get on that bus. And I use that example because we had tremendous turnover that year. We had 3 different bus drivers, and I've seen the, as far as I can tell, a real change in bus driver quality over the last 10 years from when my first son was in school to my youngest. And what I like about this bill is it brings transparency to the process. It says, it's not saying who a private company can hire or not hire. It's saying that there should be standards and that there should be transparency. And with regard to the argument that this is a private company and that's between you, sir, and your employees, I think, you know, bus transportation comes out of the general fund. These are taxpayer dollars. And so I think that parents, school boards, school districts should have as much transparency and reporting requirements as we can possibly do, because it is very, nothing is more important than the safety of our children, and we've seen, unfortunately, time and time again, how tragic it is when situations do go wrong. And so I think this is an important piece of legislation, and it did get a hearing through committee and got through that committee process. So I would hope that we keep it in the bill.
Senator Terezri.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do agree with the comments that were made by Senator Anderson and Senator Bonner. We heard this in committee, and I happen to I have talked to several people about issues of fairness with respect to payment too, that is in this provision. There are some drivers who are really not being paid for the time that they work, and I think this is an issue that we need to pay attention to. And the issue of training, I am kind of confused about. I want to make this clear. I don't know the connection. It seems like if we need to train drivers and if we do this thing, somehow we are not paying attention to kids. And I, like Senator Anderson, feel like it's the opposite. If we train drivers and if we have drivers that are committed to their work, I think this will work out. And I am not seeing the connection between leaving the kids out in the corner for long periods of time waiting, and the connection with training with drivers. So I'd like to hear that.
Mr. Chair, if I could respond.
Senator Koch.
My concern, Senator Torres-Ray, is not about the training that's going to leave kids out, but the right to refuse granted to the bus drivers, which is in Subdivision 2, Section 29. I'd rather the bus company, the schools, be making those decisions and in consultation with the bus drivers. But I think if you leave that up to one, you have the potential of having kids standing out in the cold or in the sun, either way, and they will wait for that bus. That's my concern.
I think we have some more people that would like to testify on this, too. So, Senator Olson, and then...
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if this is a correct analysis, being a metro area legislator, but having a great deal of sympathy for the rural. This seems to be a provision that has greater applicability and meaning for the metro area, and I think it fits some of the circumstances and challenges that they've been having. But in the rural area, again, I can totally understand that this seems like just a total overburden and almost irrelevant to what some of the challenges are and services rendered there, and would actually get in the way of their being able to do effective service. So I don't know. Maybe we need a above Highway 2 type of style thing, or metro area versus. Because when I listen to the comments, they're relevant. Because I, in terms of the metro area, because I know there's been really tough time recruiting drivers and so on. I'm not sure that those same kinds of circumstances apply in the rural area.
Mr. Deans, what do?
Mr. Chair, my name is Tom Deans. I'm legal counsel of the School Board Association. I'll try to be brief because we agree with the testimony from the transportation contractors on this. The department's working on a model contract that school districts could use. The basic contract that MSBA has in its book is about 3 or 4 pages. But you can deal with any of this in your specs. And let me give you an example. Senator Anderson raised some concerns with St. Paul. St. Paul has all of these provisions in its contract. The average contract is about 3 or 4 pages in the state. St. Paul's contract is 168 pages. It's got all of this stuff in there. But to the extent that in the rest of the state, where perhaps SEIU isn't as strong, they can get anything that they want to into the contract. To the extent that you want all these things added on, I would suggest to you that private contractors aren't going to do this for free, and this is going to end up costing money. That's going to be part of the cost of the contract. And in some of those places, there's not huge competition. And any additional cost the legislature puts on, they're passing right on to us. Some of the things that you've got in here, I mean, are just really overbroad. They don't need to be there. And they're kind of intrusive for people that are trying to compete with each other. For them to have all those wage rates and that for private contractors is a little over the top. On the issue with these bus drivers, the issue in Section 29, you know, you can, under this language, you can have a driver that does not understand the law and say, I'm not going out on that bus because I think those tires don't meet the standard. And if the transportation supervisor says you got to go out, he can say, no, the law says I don't have to go out. And those kids just stand out there in the snowdrift and wait. And we don't think that that's the right way to go about this. We think that this language is way overbroad and is going to have going to cost school districts a lot of money. We think that the department and the districts are trying to work this out. They can put this stuff in the specs, and they can include those kinds of training things and requirements in that in their specifications and in the model contract. And we would support Senator Scogin's amendment.
Is there a reason, and maybe all three of you have some idea of what happened, but the legislative auditor had done a study, and it's my understanding that most of these provisions in these two chapter or these two sections were not part of the legislative auditor's recommendation. Is that correct?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It is correct that these provisions are not in the recommendations of the legislative auditor. If you looked at how our original bill was drafted this year, it was drafted specifically to all the recommendations in that study. The language you have before you right now is compromise language that was partly born out of our bill we had last year, and then, unfortunately, folks not wanting to proceed forward with codifying into law all the recommendations of the legislative auditor. Now, I do want to point out that Senator Wieger and Senator Oldstein have done a fantastic job this year, and we are happy to see increases in the Type 3 buses, and that's, I believe, the bus safety bill that's out there right now. It's mainly increasing standards for the folks that drive the vans, anything smaller than a 15-passenger van. That is just one part of, you know, a much larger student transportation issue. The bill that you have before you is the one big thing the legislative auditor pointed out is a massive inconsistency in how our school districts view their responsibility to managing their student transportation systems. Although some school districts will contract out those services, it is still ultimately the responsibility of the school district to manage those systems. The school district is held accountable for those systems by our parents and our students. And so, what this is doing is it's pointing out, before you spend your public funds, school districts, please look into these set things, because these lead to a good workforce, good driver experience, and it's going to make for a more professional type of driver. Now, I do want to point out that we do understand what's going on out in the rural areas, and SEIU is not against private companies. We know that out there, that any school district that has less than 1,000 students, that it is actually more cost efficient for them right now to be serviced by a private contractor. We understand that. We know that. We will continue to work with the industry and with other advocates on this issue to address those issues. But I do think that it's very, very important that we put into law that there are certain things that school districts should look at before spending those public funds. And this is in our years of experience what we've determined.
Can we get an update as to where the department is in terms of working out that model agreement? Uh,
Mr. Chairman and members, Tom Melcher with the Minnesota Department of Education. The department convenes a transportation issues committee that meets monthly. I think they've had two meetings since the legislative auditor report came out. The issues committee includes people from the department, but also is attended by school district transportation directors and bus contractors and people from the Office of the Legislative Auditor. They've currently got a draft that they've worked on. It's not finalized yet. I think they're, a month or so away from having something finalized.
And this, Dr. Melcher, this would be available to all districts and would be recommended that they have some model and consistency across the districts then?
Mr. Chairman, yes. The department, in responding to the report from the Office of the Legislative Auditor, said that we agreed with the auditor's findings, which were that the department should provide additional guidance to all school districts in terms of best practices for transportation generally, but also developing a model contract and making that available to all school districts through our mailings that go out to the transportation directors and the superintendents, and also putting that on our website and using that as a vehicle for conference presentations, transportation director meetings and so forth.
Okay. Members, any questions? Senator Terezri.
Mr. Chair, if the Section 29, the provision that is more questionable, I just continue to feel very strongly that we do need these provisions about training and the issue of fair payment. But I think I do hear rural senators, of course, and I think that's an issue that I need to be of course, to be responsible about. And so in Subdivision 2 and on Section 29, rather than deleting the entire 28th and 29th section, I would like to suggest that we introduce language to amend that particular provision that says the school drivers who document needed bus repairs shall inform their supervisors about the bus's mechanical condition immediately for a safety-related repair on, so that it is not, that they cannot refuse to operate the bus, but that they could inform the supervisor, and it will be up to the supervisor to make that decision.
Members, I'm just wondering if it wouldn't be wise for us to wait until that model agreement gets worked out and then see what aspects might be missing that would be consistent with what you're looking at in these two sections. And I didn't ask Dr. Melcher, but whether the provisions that are in these two sections, 54 and, or sections 28 and 29, are in that model agreement, but it might be a little bit early for him to know. But Dr. Melcher, are you? I mean, this might be something that we don't have to actually do.
Mr. Chairman, Tom Melcher at the Department of Education. I don't have a copy of that with me, so I don't know the specifics. I know that that our transportation people have been working on it pretty hard, but I don't know exactly what's in there. We can certainly check on that and find out.
All right. Yes, and then we have to move on. We've got a stack of amendments here that we need to work through. So,
thank you. I appreciate your time. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SEIU feels a strong need to actually codify something into law. We have been looking at model examples and recommendations for years on student transportation issue. And if anything that the legislative audit report pointed out is that the level of our school districts as far as taking responsibility for that and where they view their responsibility for the managing of their student transportation systems is varied for a number of reasons. And we would certainly hope that you would feel a strong need to codify the things that we have before you because these are important issues to driver experience, student safety, and a more cost-effective system. We're spending public funds here. And I know, every conversation that we've had with parents clearly indicates before you spend my public funds, yes, I want school districts to ask for this information so they understand the stability of the workforce within that company.
Okay. Ms. Allswager?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allswager, Education Minnesota. And just briefly, I want to go on record. Education Minnesota supports these provisions, and we would oppose the amendment, mainly for the two reasons. One, we think that this full disclosure is a very good thing so that districts are getting the best value for the dollars that they are spending. And most importantly, about student safety. We shouldn't be compromising anything, and by knowing more information and having that information up front, I think it's for the best for the kids. Thanks.
Okay. Members on the A27 amendment, Senator Scogin's amendment, any further discussion? Senator Wieger.
Yes, Mr. Chair, very briefly, we had a lot of discussion on this in committee, as you know, and I want to acknowledge Senator Dibble, who's here, the chief author of this provision, and he's worked with a number of stakeholders. But keep in mind the fundamental issue. It's student safety, and there's nothing wrong with providing these disclosures. And I think you need to inject some common sense on the example of whether a student is going to not be picked up for a particular reason. I would assume that the district would have the common sense to send out a safe bus. If there is a bus that is not safe, shame on the school district, shame on the state for condoning such a system. We react too many times to tragedies, to victims, and then are we going to come back after we don't have something in place that says, oh, that bus was not safe, we better do something. This provides some remedies, and yes, I feel strongly about it.
Okay, on Scogin's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Division.
Division has been requested. All those in favor of the Scogin motion, please raise your hand. Those who are opposed, raise their hand. The motion does not prevail.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Members.
Mr. Chair, on that same provision, I do have a minor amendment that I believe would be supported by industry, I'm told. If this provision was to stay in, and I don't have it in writing. It's a simple oral amendment, if I could, since we were just on this section.
Sure. Senator,
at line 45.20 and 45.21, insert for cause after from service.
45.20 after what word or is it?
And 45.21 insert for cause after the words from service and then delete the direction of the local school district.
Okay, on
Mr. Chair,
Senator Anderson.
I'm confused. Senator Wieger, are you moving just that we put that sentence in, back in by itself, as amended? What's the motion in front of us? This language is now out of the bill.
No, the motion did not prevail, so the language is still in the bill.
Sorry, Mr. Words.
I apologize.
Senator Wieger.
And Mr. Chair, is it clear what the
No, you have to repeat it one more time.
at lines 45.20 and 45.21, after the words "from service," insert "for cause," and delete the words "at the direction of the local school district." And to speak briefly to it, I have Ms. Nelson.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay. Okay, I think people understand that. So, all right, all those in favor of the verbal motion of Senator Wieger's motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. All right, Senator Bonhoff.
Mr. Chair, I move the A52 amendment.
Okay, A52.
Okay.
Senator Bonhoff.
Mr. Chair, this is a friendly amendment. Just to give some background, I have been working with several people over the past couple years, actually, looking at how we might be more efficient with regard to providing student bus transportation. And we have talked, even in this committee, about how in some districts they are so close to each other, and for districts to have each district to have their own student bus transportation garage and their own dispatcher. And in some cases, in the rural areas, we have school buses crisscrossing each other as they go to pick up their children. And so there seems to me that there would be some savings and some more efficient way of working if we could look at how to cooperate regionally with regard to student bus transportation. And so what this bill does is it allows for a couple of pilot projects where two or more contiguous school districts, and these could be in the suburban school districts and as well to try a pilot in outstate area, where we allow school districts to come together and form a cooperative board at their own discretion to provide regional student bus transportation.
Okay.
What we've also done in this bill is this amendment permits these two pilot projects and requires a report back to the legislature.
All right. I was just looking at the provision on actually section 66, trying to get a insight into that. The last sentence in section 66, Mr. Nauman, do you?
Mr. Chair, I'm reading through this myself. Okay.
Members, do you have any questions on this?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Is this something that we have to put into law in order for them to do this if they want?
You know, I think, I don't know, to be honest. Mr. Deans maybe has a better idea, but the I remember one time up in our area, we wanted to develop a new football field, but we didn't want the college, the community college, to. They needed a new football field, and the high school needed a new football field, and so we started thinking that, you know, it makes a whole lot more sense if we do a nice football field and all of the teams use it. And so we tried to, we got the city, the county, the school district, and the community college all together. And we kind of forced them to work together. But there were a lot of hurdles. You know, who pays what, and, you know, who owns what. And, I mean, it's all, anytime you set up boundaries or have boundaries, there's laws protecting property, and in this case, you are talking about working together with two entities. So there's, I don't know, Mr. Deans, do you, can you give us some insight in if more than one district wants to get together on busing, what would?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Tom Deans. I'm legal counsel of the School Board Association. I'm not fully up to speed on this amendment, but under the Joint Powers Act, any two or more governmental units can enter into an agreement to do anything either one of them can do. And you could have multiple ones. You could have a whole, you could have 40 of them. Now, what this bill does is it, or this amendment does, as I read it real quickly, is it sets up a whole, a whole sort of free-functioning governmental unit, kind of like your vocational centers or your education districts or that. I mean, it's got a much more fixed methodology here that you'd have in statute rather than having them work those things out locally. I'm not sure under this whether whether this group would be able to do to levy or do bonding, because there is some language that talks about the center pledging such contracts as a source of repayment of its bonds and obligations. So I don't know whether this allows them to do bonding. I guess that would be a good thing from my perspective, but not necessarily such a good thing from your perspective, I suppose. But you, the answer to your question, the simple answer is under the Joint Powers Act, they can enter into any sort of agreement they want to do anything that one of them could do. So you could have five districts enter into an agreement that they would do their transportation jointly with some board to run that.
And Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Deans, and they established a Joint Powers Board also then under that kind of arrangement to make decisions and set up the terms and so forth of that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, yes, they could do it that way, or they could say that this district is the lead district and they're going to do it on behalf of all the other ones. Sometimes when you're out, it depends on where you are. If you're out in the country, you may have the one big dog and lots of littler districts around, and they'd have the big one do the thing for everybody. In other places where everybody's, you know, about the same size and that, they may set up a board to make sure that how it runs. That's something they would work out at the local level.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonhoeff.
I started working on this when I was speaking to the superintendent of the Minnetonka School Districts, and he talked about how he really believed that the school district should not be in the business of busing children, that in fact that ought to be looked at as something separate, and that began the conversation. And since then, people have come into my office knowing I was interested in this. We had a group from southern Minnesota, from the regional cooperative down there. They were interested in doing this. Some school districts in the western suburbs were interested. But in each case, they didn't get over the hump because it's complicated, and they couldn't figure out a way to make this happen. And so by doing this legislation, the intent is we would actually now have something that says we're looking for a couple pilots. And I think that it would actually give the incentive for these school districts to take a look at this and see if, in fact, it would be worth pursuing. And I do have Morgan Freeman would like to answer a question.
We have another. Senator Scogin, you want to?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Senator Bonhoff, did this go through committee at all?
Senator Bonhoff.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scogin, this, unfortunately, because of the timing, did miss the deadline. And so the reason that I brought it forward today is because when I talked to the various groups, nobody had any opposition to it. And I talked to the people who were interested in this, and so I was hoping that it would be considered in that way. But I appreciate your comment that it did not get through committee.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Scogin,
and collaboration, you know, again, in rural Minnesota is a good thing. I mean, we need to find new ways to work together. But we're looking at setting up pilot projects and creating a governing board. And I might like to have seen this walk through committee. I understand we're up against some tight deadlines, but
okay.
We're going to hear testimony today that we should have heard in committee.
Mr. Freeman, please go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Morgan Fleming, and Senator Bonhoff, it happens to me often. Morgan Freeman, he's so damn famous, you know. I should be so lucky. But anyway, I'm here on behalf of SAIU. I'm not a transportation person. I work mostly in benefits and pension stuff, and schools employ bus workers and other workers that are in SIU and Teamsters and others are in PRA, so that's what I mainly care about or work on. But this line 1-8 that says May, and then we've spent a lot of time reading the legislative auditor's report you folks have seen in January, and it seems to have some themes, and that is that though there's positive correlations in some things, it seems to be confused on the 340 school districts, not by any design, but there's some good news on some things in some places. And this suggestion or nudge or recognition of districts coming together seems to be a well-thought thing. SEIU, I can't really speak for them totally, but I would think that they're contiguous school districts in the metro area, and they would most likely like to participate in this. I don't know about other organized units that for school bus employees, but we'd be for such a thing. We would participate.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roblin.
I really question the need for this. I have some concerns, too. If you form these large units and we have disagreement over contracts, then you have, you know, three, four, or five districts potentially with drivers on strike that can't get their kids to school until they get a settlement that they're happy with. And they hold school districts in multiple numbers, you know, up for educating students if you don't have the transportation to get them there. And so I just wonder if this is really beneficial and how much individual school boards will have control over this particular transportation entity. And I think that they would probably be reluctant in many cases to give up control, and I know this is voluntary at this point, but I just wonder where it's going to lead.
Yeah, I guess the question that goes through my mind is can two or more districts do this under current law, you know, like through joint powers? And it seems like they could, but I mean I don't there's also some there's a lot more language here than I think they actually need. Mr. Nauman, is there, you want to address the levy?
Mr. Chairman, I don't see any specific state aid impacts here directly, although in some cases it's not clear under the financing Certainly Subdivision 6 makes an allusion to a levy impact on lines 2.21 and 2.22 that the assessments shall be paid with a levy of each participating district. That would appear to be a levy expansion, although I'm not sure it gives the department very clear direction in terms of how to certify that levy if this organization or this new public corporation were truly set up. I'm not sure that it's clear how the department would spread those levies. I would assume it would be on the participating districts, but I'm not exactly certain how that would occur. But certainly we would need to track a levy and have a completed fiscal note on this new language.
All right. Any other questions or anybody else that would like to testify? Senator Therese Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Bonoff, I'm kind of curious about the composition of this governing board. Could you tell me about, it seems like in Subdivision 3, this is a public corporation, and in Subdivision 4, there is a governing board of 3 members. Is the number related to a specific, the decision of 3 members? These are independent. I don't see any.
Mr. Chair, Senator Torres Ray, you know, the genesis of this particular language came when Steve Kelly actually had done much work on trying to do a pilot project of this type. And so that was where they came up with the structure for the governing board. But back to, and if Mr. Fleming has more comments on that, he can address that. But back to Senator Roebling, if you look at the governing board, it is from the school board members, so I don't have a sense. We're talking about that is who are making these decisions. I don't have a sense that this would open some Pandora's box and result in strikes. I don't know why you would have that concern. I don't have that at all. And the superintendents I spoke to didn't raise that as a concern. They raised it as something that they think we ought to, in these times, be looking at. So.
Okay. On Senator Bonhoff's amendment, any further discussion? Senator Wieger?
Support the amendment.
Okay. All right. All those in comments. Does this? I'm just thinking. Do we have setting up boards or public corporations, do we have to go through any other committees? Does anybody know?
Mr. Chairman,
I don't know.
That was my question. I wanted to know because there is a composition, there is a governing board, and then there is in Subdivision 3, you say that there is a public corporation created under Subdivision 2. So I wanted to know that question, but I didn't get an answer.
All right. On Senator Bonhoff's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Both one.
Division.
Please, all those in favor, raise their hand. Raise them nice and high. Okay, opposed, raise your hands.
2, 3, 4, 5 Send your hands walking in. Team in favor or not?
Yeah. Senator Hand, do you want to vote?
Is that the tiebreaker?
What are we voting on?
That was a tight
the regional time. Bus.
Okay. Motion prevails. 7-6. All right. Any other amendments? Senator Salzman.
Yes, I'd like to move the A48 amendment.
A48. I'm not sure what it is. This year we're getting all kinds of quite complex, intricate amendments.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that this amendment is something that has been a work in progress, and as this as the literacy initiative that Senator Olson and I have worked on, I think this just keeps making it better and better. So I think that this addresses many of the concerns that have been expressed about this, and I know that you have some documentation in your handout today regarding the list of organizations who oppose this. I would start out by questioning some of them, especially the Principals Association, because I have spoken with the executive director of the Principals Association, and there is no board position on this. So I'm not sure if this is an accurate list or not. Perhaps those who are here would like to inform us. And I also want to refer to a letter dated March 16th, and I'll go through those to illustrate how this amendment addresses many of the concerns that have been raised about this. Just to go through the amendment briefly, some of the changes that have been made, and some of these were made prior to the bill getting to us, but there's some changes starting on page 39 where we drop on line 39.5, we drop a Minnesota Reading Instruction Competence Assessment to just an assessment of
excuse me, Ms. Chair, we need several more copies of the amendment, including
okay,
myself.
Okay, we'll have some more copies made, and it'll just take a couple minutes, but I think we can continue to go through the amendment. And then there are a number of people I want to testify to. So, Senator Salzman.
So some changes made in terms of the name of the assessment has been dropped. I have worked with the Board of Teaching regarding implementation dates. So begin on page 40, line 13, that this assessment would be effective for new teacher licensure candidates effective January 1st of 2011. Probably the most significant change is on line 114 of the A48 amendment, and that is the assessment of reading instruction. And we have worked with the Board of Teaching. We've worked with the Department of Education. We've tried to seek stakeholder input to, again, we go back to these are reading strategies that are already in statute, have been in statute for a number of years, and the intent of this legislation is really to put some muscle behind that, in that the assessment of reading instruction will be selected by the Board of Teaching and then in cooperation with the Commissioner of Education, and must measure at a minimum the knowledge, skill, and ability of pre-kindergarten and elementary licensure candidates in comprehensive scientifically based reading instruction as defined in Section 122A.06. Test content areas must assess foundations of reading development, development of reading comprehension, reading assessment, instruction, and integration of knowledge and understanding. And what's very important to note here is that the Board of Teaching may incorporate the requirements of this subdivision into other teacher licensure examinations. So this is not necessarily a standalone test. It could be incorporated into other reading assessments. So one of the questions that has been brought forward is that this would be an extra test, an extra expense for teacher licensure candidates. We really, truly have questioned the current reading examinations, and I think the Board of Teaching will also acknowledge that currently a teacher licensure candidate could flunk all of the reading questions and still pass the exam. So we applaud the efforts of the Board of Teaching to work on new reading standards. If they choose to incorporate a new assessment, these areas could be included in that. So we believe we have addressed that concern. We have deleted all of the language that refers to pretest scholarships for teachers, so we've dropped all of the things that cost money. That was something that we thought was a good discussion point, but all of that has been dropped. We then go down further to talk about that the tests would be selected or adopted, I believe, by March 1st of 2010, and that we would like to be informed of that by March 15th of 2010. We do continue to include language that we are not approving the rules by the Board of Teaching on the new reading standards, but we just like to be informed about those. So it's sort of our way of just monitoring what is happening in this particular area. So I believe that that reflects most of the changes, but we certainly are looking to the Board of Teaching to adopt this test, and that we do use the word adopt because that's what they formally do. We've talked to the Board of Teaching. We've talked to the department. We've asked for stakeholder input. On your letter here of March 16th, I think we've addressed some of those. We are not, proposing a specific test. So I think that addresses the fact that the proposed test was developed in the state of Massachusetts. The test will be costly to teachers required to take it. It could be an existing test. It could be incorporated, so it's not necessarily an additional test, so I think that addresses some of those issues. We dropped the piece where we were attempting to put dollars into staff development. And I'm frankly surprised that people would be against us supporting staff development, but that seems to be a concern. So we look at some of these other questions here, but the whole intent of this legislation is that we have heard testimony. I know that Education Minnesota is against this. Some people have said we haven't talked to teachers, and I would argue that this comes because we have heard from teachers. We haven't heard a lot from the experts, but we've heard from first-year teachers who continue to tell us that they didn't feel prepared. Very concerned about that. So certainly we believe that we are listening to many of the grassroots and the people who are in classrooms and after they're trained saying, if I had had these skills earlier, if I had had a better start, I could have been a better teacher. So we totally applaud ongoing staff development. We think that's very important. And Senator Olson, you may have some other comments to make as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Senator Salzman.
I can make just a few.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Salzman. I was just noting on one of the papers that was here that there's no data. There's a comment that there's no data to support the idea that testing teachers will improve teaching and learning in our schools. But we do already have the Praxis 1 and 2 tests, and I do believe that the Board of Teaching has acknowledged that they do need to make some changes there because they aren't very adequate, particularly in testing. And I don't think there's any claim made that somehow that test is necessarily a total predictor of quality or competent teaching. But it does at least measure what has been taught and what has been learned in the process of that preparation. And I think there can be some indications as to whether there's been some voids in that preparation, particularly in relation, in this case, to what this body has worked on for 8 years. We have had in statute some policy regarding reading and the teaching of reading. And we've refined that over the time, and I think there's still a concern that there's some evidence that the policy that is in our statute has not been fully addressed, and it is still showing in the fact that we have many young readers that are not reaching the proficiency stage, and we believe that this is one of the most critical things that we can be teaching, and it's why we feel an obligation to continue to find ways to just keep the pressure on, if you will, try to guide in meaningful ways to improve the teaching of reading. And in doing that, it means making it possible for teachers to be more effective because they are critical to the process, and we want them to be as effective as they can be.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Senator Salzman.
I just need to add that page 2 of the A48 amendment may be missing, so I'd like to add an oral amendment to the A48. And that is on page 65, delete section 59, which is the scholarships. And I do not believe there is a fiscal note on this because the test, as it's developed, that usually when tests are developed, the cost of the development is included in the fee that is charged for the test. So there is no fee in terms of a staff development, and perhaps Ms. Baumer could confirm that.
Okay, Senator Salzman, section 59 on page 65 is also included. That should be deleted?
Yes, correct, Mr. Chair.
All right, that'll be added to the amendment. Ms. Baumer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Karen Baumer with the Minnesota Board of Teaching. Very briefly this morning to Senator Saltzman's last comments, I believe that that is correct. There should not be a fiscal impact of this bill. Unlike student K-12 tests, when the students don't pay for the tests, I believe there's a cost to the state for the development of those student tests. Teacher preparation licensure tests are different. In general, when those tests are developed, there is not a cost to us as the state agency because the test developer, the vendor, will recoup those costs from the teacher candidates themselves when they take the test. So there should not be a cost for the development of an assessment. And as mentioned, this could be embedded into existing licensure test requirements anyway. So all that to say, we, the Board of Teaching, do support this amendment and the amended language and appreciate the discussions that have led to the place that we have before you today.
Okay. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on this amendment? Ms. Halswager? And if you would, if you could please address, and I know it's difficult because with the page and line amendments, it's hard to realize what's in and what's out. But if you could try to keep your comments to the amendment versus the language, or it should be toward the amended language, if you could.
Mr. Chair, Jan Allswager, Education Minnesota, I wonder if I could ask a clarification question. On page 40, lines 1 and 2, does that then mean that there is a reading test for those teachers who are already in the profession? It implies that, but I...
Senator Salzman.
On that point, Mr. Chair, that section was dropped in the higher ed committee. We dropped section, this was for I believe, relicensure, that section was dropped in higher ed. So that
Senator Salzman, let me just clarify. Are we talking about section 24?
I believe we are talking about section 23. Section 23, which talks the Board of Teaching may grant continuing licenses only to those persons who have met board criteria, and that our original proposal also required that where applicable for relicensure, a teacher would have to pass this assessment. And that section was removed in higher education, and I noted that at our meeting last week.
Okay.
Twice.
All right.
So, Mr. Chair, clarification. That would just...
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, that would mean that the language that is on page 40, line 1 and 2 should not be in there as additional language. That needs to be corrected then.
Mr. Chair, I don't think there was an engrossment between higher ed and this bill, but we noted that, I think, last week when we went over this.
But
okay,
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Olson.
But, Mr. Chairman, Senator Saltzman, the amendment today amends a part of that, except that it misses the correction of the change of wording of instruction competence in that. So that still if continuing licenses was intended to be removed, which I believe it was in higher ed when we did it in higher ed, that actually the new language on page 40, line 1 and 2 should be deleted.
Right.
Okay.
Is how it would be.
I want to be sure that Senate
is that
Council.
Correct or not?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, the A19 amendment that was adopted in higher ed deleted on page 40 the new language on lines 1 and 2.
Right.
So the section is still in there, and this amendment, the A19 amendment also changed the effective date for this section, but the effective date is in there again because there was an additional change to that.
So all that needs to be corrected now, Mr. Chair and Shelby, is the removal of the new language on lines 1 and 2.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, the A19 amendment still holds. It just isn't engrossed.
Okay.
So it didn't need to be repeated.
So it doesn't need to be done, but know that it isn't
it's
there.
Correct.
All right.
All right. Senator Rummel, did you have a...
My question has just been answered.
Okay. Ms. Allschweiger?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Jan Allschweiger, Education Minnesota. I will try to keep my comments to the amendment. We believe that this amendment is an effort to try to improve the language. It has been stated that it is a work in progress. This amendment is. I can tell you that Education Minnesota has not been consulted or contacted about this amendment. And so for us personally, it is hard for us to take this amendment today and say that we could support this. I would recommend that if you were working on this again, this bill again tomorrow, that maybe you consider it tomorrow so that people have a chance to review it and we can show it to some of our experts. In terms of the assessment for the reading instruction and the concept that was laid out that first-year teachers are saying that they need this, you know, a scientist, a doctor, any profession is not the same professional 20 years down the road as they are when they first start teaching. I think that's for a legislator is not the same legislator that they were after 20 years. Think how much you've learned in 2 years, some of the legislators that are here. And that's why we advocate for professional development all of the time. Tests are not necessarily what is going to drive the improvement that a new teacher needs for their career. The ongoing professional development is much more important than assessments. Now, I'm not here to unilaterally say assessments are bad. But what we are doing with this, which is the first time I've ever seen it, in my 14 years at the legislature, lobbying on education, this is the first time that I am seeing political decisions being made about how to instruct kids. And we have talked about standards, reading, language arts, math standards. That's very appropriate. You are setting the goals of where you want our schools and our kids to be. But with this legislation, you are now getting into the mode of telling teachers how to teach. And I don't think that is where we want to go in the legislature. Set the standards, but let's not get into the instruction piece of it.
Yeah, Senator Salzman.
Yes. Under that point, Mr. Chair, I would welcome, I believe that, you know, Mr. Chair, you made a very important point last week on Wednesday when you said if anyone had any problems with any provisions in this bill, go talk to the author. And I had people come talk to me, but you know, Education Minnesota was not one of them. And I think you have enough lobbyists that you certainly could have found me over the past week to do that. So I'm very disappointed that you come to the table and say I haven't reached out to you when I have responded to emails. I think I've responded to almost every email that I've gotten, never gotten anything back. But sort of like I'm very disappointed, and I had an appointment with your president who canceled it. So maybe that, you know,
we do have time between now and tomorrow morning.
Absolutely.
So.
But I do want to speak briefly to the fact that this is going to determine curriculum or how we teach reading, and that there is another section in statute that talks about reading And I checked with Ms. McQuay about that, and we already have in statute that school districts can pick the curriculum that they use. They should train their teachers in those. We are in no way limiting, restricting, or mandating. We're just saying there needs to be more tools in the toolbox. I would argue that we're doing the exact opposite. We're trying to make sure that some strategies of reading, we believe and we hear, are not being adequately covered, taught, instructed. And this is a very strong message of saying we have to include all of them. I've heard from Education Minnesota that phonics is a right-wing conspiracy. And I've heard that. And that is very disappointing. If anyone wants to talk about that, that this is a political issue, that's making it a real political issue. Phonics, this is not to impose it on any child. It's not that bad of a thing. Children learn very differently, and if phonics works for some kids, I certainly hope the teachers have the skills to use them.
Did you have a comment that you'd like to make? Please give your name for the record.
My name is Gretchen Harriman, and I am here as a parent of several children, one of which has special needs and has required different reading instruction. I'm here as a K-12 curriculum specialist for White Bear Lake, working with both elementary and secondary teachers and principals, and also as a licensed language arts teacher with experience in middle school, high school, regular ed, and alternative education settings. And first of all, I would like to say I appreciate the fact that it sounds like this is not legislating one type of program, one specific type of staff development for all teachers. And just would like to share with you a little bit about the work that we do, which is very complex. But in the last 15 years that I've been in an educator.
I hate to interrupt somebody who's testifying, but could you kind of address the amendment, or I know we're going to get caught either that or we'll be sitting here all day.
To the part about the specifically your comment about the phonics,
okay.
Because we work very hard in school districts to look at the student data that we have in front of us. Things have changed. We have constantly changing standards. We see a need for phonemic awareness, learning about phonics, vocabulary acquisition, reading strategies. There are multiple measures that we have that we assess to look at what every student needs to show growth. This is a result of both state and federal mandates, legislation, and we're working hard to do that, to incorporate these things. My concern with the proposed legislation is that it would take us away from that and legislate one type of program for all students. So being able to see...
Excuse me, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, could you explain how it does that?
I think there's where... Do you try to address the amendment? I don't know if it exactly changes that, but it was my understanding that, Senator Salzman, when you explained it, that it's not specific to one approach.
Mr. Chairman, there's nothing that we have done that has attempted to do anything different than what has been in law for years, that says in terms of the teaching of reading that a comprehensive, scientifically based reading strategies that cover all five strands. And I hear some of the arguments coming back and, you know, wanting to ignore one or two of them. And those who have researched and gone into the syllabi, believe it or not, there's somebody that has read all of the syllabi for all 28 of the teacher preparation institutions and have found them wanting in terms of how they are preparing teachers to teach. We're not saying how they have to teach. It's that they are prepared to teach. That is the issue here. And so where one would get the idea, I think that if people are out there and the districts are functioning in ways that hopefully are effective, that they are using all of the five strands and they're preparing or they have equipped, whether it's after the fact or they've been fortunate to find teachers who have come prepared with some foundation in it, then I'm not sure what the fuss would be about with this. There's just some evidence that that is not the case overall, and we have a statewide responsibility, and we're attempting to essentially maybe expose that a bit and see if we can keep pushing and moving toward that end. So I haven't heard from anything you've said why you should have any concern with this.
No, Senator Olson, my point is just that teachers, it's the same way as a parent. When you leave the hospital with a baby, you have some foundational knowledge. You don't have practitioner expertise. So to say that teachers aren't prepared when they exit colleges, it's because they haven't had all that time and experience with different populations, different learners. So I thank you for saying that it's not saying that there's one test that meets the need for all. What I am saying is that we need to be able to locally look at our staff development, our curriculum, and be fluid, continually ongoing, meet the needs of our teachers and our students. We look at data all the time to identify which students need to have further intensive programs. There are multiple programs that meet the needs of students, not just one.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know what the one is because we're not prescribing any. So hopefully you're looking at the kind that have the variety that will address it, because we've heard multiple stories, human stories of parents who have struggled and have not been able to get anywhere with their local schools and have had to do it on their own and feel that because they had the means, that's not right, that those who have children that are struggling readers have not been able to get that kind of a service within their public schools, and that is a key reason that we want to keep this going. So if if people are doing it and you're having the success, and it'll show in the special ed rates that you have, if we're getting it done by third grade, we won't have the people going into needing the learning disabilities, because that's with a major source of learning disabilities in our special ed costs. So the evidence will show in terms of that effectiveness. And if it does, I say more power to you. You should not have any great feelings of consternation over what this is proposing.
And members, that was from the ranking minority leader. Member. Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It sounds like we have the larger discussion going on about the issue, but right before us right now is the A48 amendment, and it sounds like Senator Saltzman is moving this in the right direction. And so I would suggest that we just at least adopt this amendment and then allow her to continue working on this till tomorrow. So I'd like to move us along on that.
All right. Senator Saltzman, A48 amendment. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Saltzman and members. Any further amendments? More amendments? Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair, very simple one. Should take about a minute. 1458 amendment. Is that the right number? I gave it to you last week.
Upper right-hand corner.
Yeah, I know. That's what it says. Do you... Yeah, she's got it. This is quite simply just...
Why don't we just a second here, and we'll let the amendments get to members.
Page 70.
It's on page 70.
It's a rest amendment.
Mr. Chair, this is just to tidy up some language that we intended to fix when it was going to the committee in local government, and it inadvertently just got missed. And it's when establishing an advisory council for a pilot program for alternative learning centers, it's just tidying up the language of the advisory council is all.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
They're just going to include the minority. He doesn't want to say it, but.
Oh, yeah. That was not purposely left out.
Okay. Senator Wieger, this bill, our legislation has gone through state and local government, hasn't it?
Yes.
Okay. All right. On Senator.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Senator Rowland.
This is something we've been doing routinely, and it did get missed in the committee because we've been trying to get the appointments made by the minority leaders instead of the Committee on Rules, so that we don't have to wait for that committee to meet in order to get some of these appointments done.
Okay.
The amendment's a thoughtful improvement.
All right. Senator Dahl, who's the 1458 amendment? I think everybody has that. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Any further amendments? Senator Scogin.
Mr. Chair, if you would indulge me to get everybody on the bus one more time, I would like to bring back a little local control and maybe change a little bit the right of first refusal and that transportation language.
Senator Scogin, is it a verbal amendment?
No, it is not. It is A26.
A26?
It will be on page 44 and 45, committee. I can walk you through it while it's being passed out. If you'll go to line 27 on page 44.
Okay. Why don't you just wait one minute here, and it's always a little more reassuring if members have the copy of the amendment in hand, and then the public can also. Hopefully, there's enough amendments, and then you can go ahead and explain it.
Have all this great discussion, Mr. Chair, on policy, and I keep going back to the bus ride to get there. But I mean, on line 27 on page 44, as you see, we would delete initiated and insert initial. And we would drop down to line 31 and delete including. And then we would delete the rest of the lines on page 44 and the first seven lines on page 45. Which would still leave us with a driver recruitment and retention plan. It just wouldn't be quite as prescriptive about what we would have to do to have that plan. Then we would, on line 8 of page 45... that would be the, I'm sorry, line 8 would be deleted. Line 15, we would put in an and at the end of that sentence. Then we would delete line 16 through 21. Line 22, we'd change the number to 6. And line 34, we would... let the transportation supervisor determine that a safety-related repair meeting the out-of-service definition has occurred rather than the bus driver.
So on line 32,
line 34.
Line 34.
After the word which, we would insert the transportation supervisor determines. Transportation.
Okay, on
and that, Mr. Chair, is my A26 amendment.
All right. Any discussions, members? If not, on the Scogin amendment.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I oppose the amendment respectfully for the reasons stated earlier.
All right. On the Scogin A26, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. All right. Senator Hand, I think, was next. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Can I work our way down that side?
I do have a couple of things I'd like to try to amend. One is, and going back to our discussion of last week, the section that was added in the Higher Ed Committee dealing with, I think it's section 18. I think this has to be a verbal amendment. I don't see it engrossed in the document that we have, but it's the provision that deals with the responsible family life and sexuality education programs. And as we talked a little bit last week, part of this is problematical simply because of the way that this was added to the bill, which I think did not give it an opportunity to be heard by the policy committee and did not have any opportunity for testimony on this bill in the Education Committee. And I do believe there are some folks here that might want to speak to this today on the amendment, but my amendment is simply to delete that section from the bill. And the primary reason for it is I think that it is not necessary, and it does, in my opinion, do some harm to a traditional approach to dealing with the sex ed that we've had in Minnesota schools, which has been to leave it to the discretion of local school boards. And many local school boards already have what could be termed very comprehensive sex ed programs, and to put it into statute that all districts must do this, I think, is excessive and beyond what is actually needed and beyond what people, I think, expect, and it certainly is something that's going to be addressed by local boards. So the amendment is simply to delete that section from the bill that was not heard in the Education Committee. And as I said, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if there's some folks that want to testify on this point, but if there are, I would invite them to be heard.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Chair, we're getting a piece of information here. I was just wondering who
who's sending it out.
Mr. Chair, that's from
Senator Clark.
Thank you.
I actually, Mr. Chair, had an amendment on this particular provision, which would delete subdivision 4, and I don't know how you want to proceed with that.
Senator Hand moved to delete the section. So you could amend the I suppose the easiest would be to
delete the whole section.
If the probably the easiest would be to vote on Senator Hand's motion, then deal with your motion.
Mr. Chair, that makes sense. I'm assuming that you want to go ahead and take the testimony first.
Yes, if we can maybe limit testimony. Did this come through your division or even your committee, Senator Wieger?
Mr. Chair, it did not this session. However, as we pointed out previously, legislation similar to this has passed three times.
It was added in higher ed.
Yes.
All right, Senator Wergen, and then we'll take some brief testimony.
Mr. Chair, is this, again, an unengrossed piece that I'm not finding?
It's here. Well, it's in our stuff.
Senator Wergen brings up a good point. When Senator Wieger's bill came to this committee, it was actually the amendment came with a loose two-sheet. Up in the top, it has the A-19 amendment, but that was the A-19 amendment. We'll try to get a copy for you. That came with the bill because that was added in the higher ed committee. Okay, if you'd like to give your name for the record, and please go ahead.
My name is Tom Pritchard, President of the Minnesota Family Council, and I would speak in favor of the amendment and against the mandate. Recently, there was public information or report that 1/4 of teenage girls have an STD or STI. And in the inner cities, it's upwards of 50%. And I think we know what is 100% successful in addressing the problems of pregnancy, STDs, and even abortion among our teenagers, and that's abstinence message. And yet this provision in the bill would preclude that message by requiring that comprehensive education be taught, which is basically contraceptive education. In fact, in addition to that provision, there's a repealer of current law which discusses marriage. And we just feel that this is not in the best interest of our kids, that condoms as the primary approach is the wrong message. In fact, that, if you look at what's has been taught in our schools, it's been overwhelmingly comprehensive sex education, condom message. And we feel it's been an abysmal failure in our society. It presumes sexual activity. A federal government HHS study on comprehensive sex found that most of those curriculum did not delay sexual activity. And secondly, it doesn't work. They don't prevent STDs. Last night I was reading a study in the New England Journal of Medicine where they looked at 100 women who use contraceptives, and yet 37 of those women still got the HPV virus. Many STDs are spread through non-intercourse sexual activity. So by promoting and mandating this, we feel we're heading in the wrong direction. And then finally, something was handed out on what parents want. There was recently a study that supposedly came out saying, yeah, parents really want comprehensive sex education. Well, it's interesting, if you look at that study and how it's characterized, the abstinence message is presented in the negative to parents. But secondly, there was a Zogby poll out a couple years ago that asked parents what they wanted. And when they were when it was described what comprehensive sex education includes, parents dramatically changed their view of it. They don't want this contraceptive message, the emphasis, the promotion of this on their kids. In fact, this HHS study found that the most balanced comprehensive sex education program spent seven times more time on contraceptives than they did on the absence message. So parents, when they find out what's involved in comprehensive sex, do not want it. So we encourage you to reject this mandate. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pritchard. If you could give your name for the record, please.
Yes, my name is Barbie Anderson, and I'm a teacher and a parent speaking in opposition to the sex education mandate. I do have two handouts here for members of the committee. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, passing this mandate does mean that is there somebody that could?
Hand it out.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, passing this mandate means that more and more young people, year after year, will receive the graphic content that is virtually the heart of every comprehensive sex education curriculum. You need to know what you are mandating. This past January, I attended the 2008 Minnesota School Health Education Conference, where comprehensive sex education was again featured. In your packets are examples of the curricula that was once again on display at the conference and currently in widespread use around this state. Reducing the Risk and Safer Choices are the names of these two curricula. MOAP promotes them and describes them as the most widely used curricula. You can see for yourself the graphic content in the packet. I just want to briefly give you two recent examples of what this content is like. At this school health education conference, we as teachers in the workshop on comprehensive sex education were asked to come up to the front of the room and pretend we were teenagers and participate in what I could only describe as a very degrading activity for classroom use. We were told to place sexual behavior cards on a continuum from abstinence to sexual intercourse. The behaviors included, and this is what they were, holding hands, spooning naked with your partner, open mouth kissing with clothes on, masturbating by oneself, taking a shower together, touching a breast, mutual masturbation with clothes on, fingering someone, giving a hand job, getting a hand job, going down on someone, and so on. After we arranged the words in the agreed upon order, the presenter stated what the teachers then should tell their students about this activity. And I want you to listen carefully to her comments, because these comments are typical of what is taught in comprehensive sex education. In fact, it is very strange because they don't really teach. They just give information. She said, "There is no right or wrong answer. There are different definitions of sex, different definitions of abstinence. There are different values and different definitions among us. Students need to explore these definitions in a safe environment, including talking about anal, vaginal, and oral sex. We were told that we should have our students in the health classes write down all the words that they can think of for sexual intercourse, including street talk slang, because then they can talk with their partner about their sexual needs. We were also shown in this workshop a penis model for classroom condom demonstrations and dental dams that they encourage the students to use for oral sex. They totally omit the warning from the CDC that dental dams, there is no proof that these even work, and that oral sex is now leading to oral cancer in the throat, the tonsils, and the base of the tongue. At the back of your packet, just in closing, you will see an exercise that is another one from comprehensive sex education. It's called the male and female silhouette activity. And this is recommended for grades 8 and up. And here you see the silhouette of the male and the female. And students in 8th grade are told then to draw in the body parts for the female, to put in everything from the vagina, the labia, and the breasts, and they're to draw on the young man here, the scrotum, the penis. This used to be called drawing dirty pictures. And to some people, they would call it pornography. And yet this is a part of comprehensive sex education. In fact, the sex education teacher who compiled this in what she calls outrageous teaching techniques in health education, and I agree with her title, she was the keynote speaker at this health conference. The goal of comprehensive sex education is to reduce unprotected sex. It is not and never has been to reduce teen sexual activity. And it is the sexual activity that is putting our kids at risk, not the non-use of condoms. Graphic, sexually stimulating activities in the classroom that break down natural modesty only feed into our societal problem of sex out of control, and you are considering mandating more of this. I urge you to reject this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. Senator Hamm.
Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate your hearing some testimony here. We did not, as I said, have an opportunity to have a full discussion in the Education Committee on this bill. And I think many people are familiar with this topic. This is not a new one for us. But I want to remind the members of the committee again that this is something that local school boards can do if they choose to do it. There's nothing that prohibits any school district from adopting these curriculum today. And some of them have. But I can tell you, on 8 years on the school board in Eden Prairie, I never had any parents come to me and tell me they needed more sex education in the curriculum or in the classroom. That was never a problem. I did hear from parents who would complain about what we were currently doing and ask for it to be more restrictive or ask for ways to opt out in a less controversial way. These are, I think, issues that can and should be dealt at the local level. And I think that for us to adopt as a statewide policy the mandating of this is problematic. And I think it is an intrusion into the ability of local communities and local districts to manage this in a sensitive way that meets the needs of their parents and their families. So I would urge your support, and let's take it out of the bill and move forward.
Okay, we have we had two people who spoke opposed to it. Let's have a couple people that will speak on the other side, and then I think all the members know what the provision is. So, and then Senator Clark had an amendment, I guess. So, are you speaking in favor of?
Yes.
Not in favor of the amendment or the motion by Senator Hand, but in favor of the language. All right. Please give your name for the record.
Dr. Deborah Burnett.
Who is?
Mr. Chair, members of the panel. I am a clinical associate professor in the School of Nursing at the University of Minnesota. My work in adolescent health draws on my expertise in both the area of public health and education. I received my doctorate in epidemiology. I also have a master's degree in education and my certificate to teach kindergarten through eighth grade. I'm also a mother of two young daughters, so I have more than a scientific interest in this topic that affects so many of our young people. Today I'm going to present the results of a study about what Minnesota parents are thinking about sex education in schools, and I think you all received a handout, and that's what I'll be talking about. This research was conducted by the Prevention Research Center at the University of Minnesota, which is funded by the Centers for Disease Prevention and Control. So how is this research different from what's already out there? Well, we focused on parents. Much of the current research in this area focuses on young people's attitudes. They want accurate, effective education from their schools and at home. Or their research focuses on teachers' preferences. They want training to be able to deliver state-of-the-art, effective curricula. But the last study of Minnesota parent attitudes was conducted about 7 years ago, and that was a survey of adults in general. Here we surveyed parents of 5 to 17-year-olds, because this is the group that actually has children in school. Furthermore, most of the statewide surveys of parents conducted in Minnesota and elsewhere are designed to reflect opinions about the entire state, and ours does that. But it does more, because the data in our study were collected by congressional districts. So in this way, legislators could get a better sense of their own constituents' opinions. The results I'll present today are based on 1,500 telephone interviews with parents across the entire state. The data were collected between 2006 and 2007, and they were collected by a reputable survey research center at the University of Minnesota. I just briefly want to let you know what parents were asked. Parents were asked if they thought teenagers should be taught only about abstinence, that is, not having sex until marriage, about both abstinence and how to prevent pregnancies and sexually transmitted infections, or sex education should not be taught in schools at all. We found overwhelming support for sex education in schools. 89% of Minnesota parents want sex education that includes information about abstinence as well as the prevention of pregnancy and sexually transmitted diseases among young people who have already had sex. We found very high support among all groups of parents, regardless of gender, age, race, religion, political orientation, education level, income, and congressional district. Parents across the state are clear. They want medically accurate, effective sex education for their children. In fact, 100% of respondents indicated their wish that sex education be medically accurate. But with limited standards for sex education currently in place in our state, some curricula in use may not provide medically accurate information. These results are very consistent with other states that have recently conducted similar studies to assess parental attitudes towards sex education in school. The results of this research have been published in a peer-reviewed scientific paper that's now available online in the April issue of the Journal of Adolescent Health. I'm grateful for your time and would be happy to answer any questions you have about our study now or in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. And could you give your name for the record, please? Yes.
My name is David Drake.
And are you speaking on which side?
Against the education of condoms in schools.
So you'd be opposed? No, you'd be in support of Senator Hand's motion, which would be to take it out.
Yes.
Okay. Is there anyone else that would be speaking? No. I want to just take two on each side. Actually, here, members, if you haven't made up your mind, please raise your hand. If members here don't know how they're going to vote, please raise their hand. That's exactly what I thought. So what I'd like to do is to give. Is there somebody here that would like to speak in favor of leaving or against Senator Hand's motion? Anyone else that would like to speak? Besides members, I think. Just in public. Okay. Then we'll move to some questions, and then we'll take a vote on it, because I think everybody knows exactly how they're going to vote on this. Senator Olson. Yeah,
Mr. Chairman, I was interested in the professor's discussion of the survey that was done. And I think one of the things that puzzles me, besides mandating, essentially, it virtually is mandating curriculum that we had a little bit of fuss about just earlier. But part of it is the fact that there were no religious objections at all relative to that. That seems a bit strange to me in that everything that seems to be promoted here really is kind of an amoral view. We're talking about something that is a kind of a key to some basic moral values. And I think nothing drove that home to me more than last year. Remember the flap at the Minneapolis Community College over providing foot washing facilities for the Muslims that were attending the college? And I think Catherine Kirsten had written a column, and it created quite a stir. And there was a response to it from a Muslim author in a couple days later in the paper. And I was reading along. It was a long, strip of column. But I got to this section, and it talked about considering the assault on Western values and North American culture, and whether they're claiming that foot washing was, in fact, attacking it. When, in fact, it said, Muslims may complain about a lot of issues, but I do not think they complain nearly enough about their daily torture at public bathrooms where you're provided condoms as an incentive for casual clean sex, but are severely under-equipped for a thorough washing. And it's it's kind of struck me. The Muslim community looks at the Western culture and its depravity in relation to its sexual mores and behavior. And the extremists among them think we ought not to be allowed to live because of this. And then we're going to come along and mandate that our schools provide an amoral view in this area of moral behavior.
Okay. Senator Bonhoff, and I think, remind members that I think all of us know exactly how we're going to vote. And
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonhoff, and then Senator.
Mr. Chair, and I do hear what you're saying, Mr. Chair, that we all do know how we're going to vote, but on the subject of religion, I was struck by, I have been lobbied extensively by people people who live in my community and by different groups who are very much asking me to do all that I can to make sure this passes this year. And one of the loudest groups that came to lobby me was the National Council of Jewish Women, and that's a religious group, and they feel so strongly that, you know, we need to do all that we can to arm our young people with all the information that we can so that we protect them, and that that is something that as a religious group, they are, I know they lobbied many legislators on that, and so I just want to make sure that it isn't thought that, you know, the religious community weighs in on one side and not another.
Okay. All right, Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We might well all know how we're going to vote, but I still think it's important that we discuss what's happening here, because I cannot help but feel that one testifier indicated teaching medically accurate sexual education curriculum. A whole lot of people probably don't have a problem with that, but this goes so far beyond medically accurate. This curriculum is actually an assault on conservative family values. It's nothing less than that. It teaches lifestyles that are offensive to many. And it teaches that this is okay in ways that our children should absolutely not. You know, boy, I almost can't say it fast enough. We had objections to having a full toolbox for teaching reading, and yet we want to bring this into the schools. Well, there's nothing offensive about teaching children reading, but there certainly is something offensive to a whole lot of conservative families in Minnesota that don't want this in any classroom that their children are in. I hope we understand that this information is meant for the home and meant for the family and not meant to be taught in public schools.
Senator Clark.
Mr. Chair, I just think it's important for the record to actually say what we are voting on, since Senator Hand has reminded us several times that this hasn't been talked about here. And I think that at least what Mr. Pritchard and others have said is different than what this provision does. So first off, I think it's important we all know that on lines 1.12 through 1.14, it includes an abstinence-first approach to delaying the initiation of sexual activity that emphasizes abstinence while also including education. I think as a parent that, to me, that's an important thing. Second, it promotes individual responsibility. Third, subdivision 2 talks about local control. A school district must offer, but they may independently decide, and at least the amendment I wanted to bring forward gets rid of the whole state part, which is really all about local control. But even as it currently stands, this is about local folks making local decisions about what's appropriate, having parental, if you look in sub B of that, B and subdivision 2 on lines 29 through 30, it talks about consulting with parents or guardians when establishing the policies and procedures. In subdivision 3, it talks about parents, about the importance of parental responsibility and input. It talks about parents being able to excuse their kids from some or all. In page 2, in lines 19 through 22, it talks about how kids cannot be penalized if they don't participate. All of those kinds of things, and frankly, the research has shown how important this can be. And I just want to take a slightly different bent. In my early life, I worked with a lot of at-risk kids. And also as a youth minister. Okay, so I believe my faith is very important to me, and if we could actually make it so all kids weren't doing things we don't want grown-ups doing, that would be a good thing. But I worked with, for example, a young man named Kenny. The month before he turned 15, he was the proud parent of 4 children, all by the same young woman. Their third pregnancy, she gave birth at that time. I'm sorry, Kenny was going to be sexually active, and that was unfortunate. But, you know, I think about the young women who have been abused. And I, Senator Fredericks and I participated in a sex offender, a mandating sex offender training this fall. And what I started thinking about while I was sitting there was the information that people don't have, frankly, that this is partially about preventing child abuse and helping give our young adults some tools to go forward. That if you think about who most of the perpetrators are, as sexual offenders, they happen to be family members or acquaintances. And then if you think about that small group of perpetrators that continually perpetrate, very small, they were abused when they were younger. In part, they didn't know what were the wrong and inappropriate activities. And then while I was sitting there, I also thought about St. Cloud State's Women's Center, who does a lot of work with young women who have been sexually violated. And I've seen this in other areas as well, is that oftentimes people don't actually understand. They know they shouldn't have sex, but believe it or not, they don't understand what activity it is that actually could create pregnancy or is the thing we don't want them doing. They still have misinformation. And what they've told me is that without exception, these young women have said, if they had a better understanding about what was happening, not that they were blaming themselves, but perhaps they could have gotten themselves out of a situation and prevented the abuse to begin with. So I think as we're moving forward, we need to think about all the tools. Of course it's important that we have local control and that parents are the ultimate people that make these decisions. But I think, you know, we have some pretty compelling evidence that parents want this, that parents don't have all the information, and frankly, they feel uncomfortable about it. So, Mr. Chair, I appreciate you giving me some flexibility, but this is not about a state-prescribed curricula. This is about parents and what parents are telling us.
Okay. Senator Terrazre.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I want to speak to the members as a parent and also as a child advocate today more than a member. This is incredibly important, and we need to pass this legislation. I have a couple of teenagers at home, and I have been experiencing some tremendous difficulties with communication with my teenagers about this issue and with their friends. This is an issue that they don't want to talk about, but the images and the media, the messages that they get from their friends are just unbelievable. The information that they get through media about sex is beyond my comprehension. It's something that I cannot talk about. I'm embarrassed to talk about. But my boys receive that information from friends, and we need to do something about it. And the problem that we have as parents of teenagers today is that we don't have control over that information. And not only that, they have a lot of information that comes to them and that they exchange, and we don't even know how to access that information through YouTube and all of these technology that is available to them today. And we need to provide education to our children about this issue, and we need to empower them. And I have seen with my own boy the difference. It makes a tremendous difference when he knows about these issues. When I talk to him about it, he knows that he needs to be attentive to these messages now, and that he has some knowledge about this information, and then he can make a decision about it. And he's only 14. But I am most concerned about many parents that I know that don't happen to speak the language that their children speak. And I'm talking not talking just about the technical language. I'm talking about literally not speak English. And these parents are not able to have control over their children's lives today. And they are being exposed through media and through technology, through these messages about having sex and having a wonderful time without protection and without really information that schools need to provide to them. And this is important to parents and to these children, and we have an obligation to support that effort. And I just want to speak really very strongly on behalf of the legislation that is before us. Times have changed. We can no longer just pretend that children, parents are going to talk to their children about sex and that information is available to them. Good information, real information that they need to protect themselves is not available to certain families, and we need to make it available through the schools. It's the only choice we have.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I understand that this does, as Senator Clark indicates, allow a lot of local control. And I don't know of a school district that doesn't offer sex ed. I don't know that there are any, so to say that we're mandating it is probably nothing new. And as long as we allow local control and have parental involvement, as it very clearly says in line 1.25 to 1.30 and down to 1.35 about parental notice and options that they have. I guess I feel much better about this because I know in my community in Prior Lake, we had an incident where a teacher was teaching sex ed, and she was doing some things, having the kids put condoms on their hands, and a very large group in the community objected. And they had a huge school board meeting about it. I mean, hundreds of people came to talk about how Prior Lake was teaching sex ed to kids. And they changed that program as a result of that input. But it would have been nice is as they were putting that program together that they would have asked for that parental involvement right in the beginning, which this is requiring them to do. And I think, you know, then we would have never had the issue arise, perhaps, that would be visual demonstrations might have been eliminated from that local sex ed curriculum. And so I see this as something that appears to have a lot of local values can be included in this, which is something that I, as a parent, would look for, and I would be interested in, and I would be able to get all the information because it requires that it all goes home to parents to tell them if their children are going to be in this course, and if they are, what the content will be. And plus, they have prior access to developing the course in a lot of ways. And so I don't see it as a real strict mandate as some people are indicating that it would be. And I think I would perhaps support Senator Clark's amendment to take out the state from offering a lot of a state curriculum, so to speak. Although it doesn't indicate, it just says they may offer it and schools may use it or not, so it's not mandated either. But sometimes it's too easy to fall into that standard that's presented. And I think we should be asking communities to develop their own curriculum with their own values, community values.
Okay. Senator Culp, do you need to make a comment?
Mr. Stump, I haven't heard this bill before, actually, okay, because I've not served on the education committees. And I guess I maybe was the last one at the table that went through high school, I'm guessing. I graduated in the 90s, so from high school.
Maybe we should hear your comments.
And yet I don't have a daughter in high school yet. But we had this. I go to Senator Roebling's point. Is there a school in the state that doesn't do this? And if so, how many? And I guess I'm just questioning the need, and this seems to be a very sensitive subject for people, which is why if it's happening on a local level to the local level satisfaction, does the state need to be getting involved given the sensitivity of the issue? I mean, I got this information. It was going out in the 90s. I'm sure it's still going out in this millennium. So that's my question, Mr. Chair. If somebody can answer it or whatever, I'll listen to the discussion further.
Okay. Senator Hand, you have the last word here.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the point, and Senator Koch, you made it very well. Most districts, in fact, I would wager every single one, has got sex ed programs that are amenable to their local communities, and sometimes they get changed. And if it is as benign as it has been described, then there is absolutely no need for it in the law. If it has no effect, then we don't need it. And so if it does have an effect, then we ought to put it in. And so then you say, what is the effect of doing it? And the effect of putting the mandate in is to encourage the adoption of comprehensive sex ed programs by schools that don't currently have that style of sex ed program. And whether or not a community wants that or feels it's of value, it should be up to that community. And I think for us to pass this at the state level and say this is the model, this is what every district should have, is just not right. We know we have a problem with sexual activity, with diseases. I would suggest that the evidence is that these comprehensive sex ed programs haven't proven to be effective because there are many districts that currently use them, and they have just as big, if not a bigger, problem than everybody else. So, again, this is not something that should be subject to state policy and state mandate. This is a local issue. It's being handled appropriately at the local level right now. Let's leave it there. Let's not make this a statewide mandate on how we're going to deal with sex ed.
Okay. On Senator Hand's motion to delete the A-19 amendment, or A-19 language, All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Division.
Division has been requested. All those in favor of Senator Hand's motion, please raise their hand. All those opposed, please raise their hand. Motion prevails on 9-9 vote.
Fails.
On a 9-9 vote.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Clark.
I move to delete subdivision 4.
Senator Clark moves to delete on page 2, subdivision 4.
Just subdivision.
That is the provision that relates to the Department of Education, and I believe that's the subdivision that the cost,
unless the district wants.
The fiscal cost is attached to. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. We have a completed fiscal note that shows $113,009, $104,010, and $11,000, and the cost seems to be driven by assumptions that the department will be providing assistance to districts.
Okay. Everybody understand that? Subdivision 4. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Can I ask about the repealer? The repealers, I guess there's several. What those are.
Senator, or Senate Counsel, could you...
Mr. Chair, members, the repealer contains a couple parts. One was already in the bill, but you had to make things plural, and that's why one part doesn't relate to the actual provision that was adopted. But the 120A.23 is the repealing the current language and statute regarding, I can't remember what, I think it's sexually transmitted diseases and infections and whatever the, I think Mr. Nauman's flipping through the pages now, the actual title for the section that is being repealed.
Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not an expert on this, but the head note is programs to prevent and reduce the risks of sexually transmitted infections and diseases.
What was the other one?
Doesn't relate.
Mr. Chair, members, that's actually not related to this provision. It was already in the in SEN file 3001. It's just the way they for the revisor system going. Okay. It's so that's no change from the current bill. It's just adding the 121A.23 is where the change is actually happening.
Okay, members, any other amendments?
Yeah.
Senator Olson, I believe.
Chairman, I have a simple little amendment here. A51. Mr. Chairman, the reason I'm doing this is because Senator Wigger has been envious of me for having chief authored the bill to make ice hockey the official sport of the state of Minnesota, and so now I'm giving him an opportunity to be that chief author. I've had a wonderful batch of co-authors, and we've actually worked together as a team. And as a result of the reason I think it belongs in this bill, I'll tell you why. First of all, it has been passed out of committee and is on the floor, but unfortunately, the House of Representatives apparently had a flood of proposals for state symbols, and they decided not to hear any of them. And I've been here 25 years, and over that period of time, we've passed 6 state symbols. At least 3 of them that I know of were instigated by school-age children, elementary children.
the monarch butterfly. Before that, I believe the state mushroom. Not mushroom, the state muffin. And I'm not sure who proposed the mushroom. I know Senator Phyllis Kahn or Representative Kahn had that. And then a couple of years ago, the state fruit, which was the Honeycrisp apple. And it was interesting. I belong to the Arboretum. And in the Arboretum News, one of the recent ones that came out, they said in 2006, one of the HRC's most celebrated apples received an extra juicy honor that acknowledges the state-long tradition researching cold, hardy fruits and plants. The Honeycrisp, a product of more than 40 years of University of Minnesota research, was named the state's official fruit. So these symbols, sometimes we make fun of them, but the reality is that I think both for tourism but also for in the social studies, I think fifth grade social studies, it must be in their curriculum because they do look at the meaning and significance of the state symbols. Last spring, a class came from Groveland Elementary School, and we were talking out on the Capitol steps. And wonderful class. They had good questions. And when we were done, this young man, and I'll pass this picture around because these two children from that school are the ones that picked up as an assignment in that class of making ice hockey the state sport. They're both goalies in their youth hockey, Hannah and Brandon. And Brandon came up to me and he said, you know, we've been studying the state symbols, and he had an assignment, and he said, we noticed that there wasn't a state sport and we think it should be hockey. Can you help us? Well, what are you going to say? I said, sure, I think I can help you. It was about 3 days before the end of session. And so I had a bill drafted. I'll send this along because had a bill drafted and introduced it and let them know. They were out over the interim gathering signatures supporting it and were excited when I contacted them and said we were going to be able to get a hearing. So they came down to the Capitol to do that. And I could go in and try to sell you. I'm not a big sports, enthusiast of all, but I do value the importance of sports and team sports, and I've thought about it mostly in this committee, because I think that particularly our team sports are demanding of individuals to bring some excellence to their endeavor as a part of a team, and we want to develop teamwork, and yet they engage in it in a competitive environment. Those are all kinds of things that you cope with in life. And I reflecting on it further with hockey, hockey goes a step further. There are rules, and if you break the rules, you get stuck in a penalty box in front of God and everyone, and to be belittled. And then you have to sit there, and you have to watch your teammates go shorthanded, trying to stand up and hold their own. And so I thought, hockey, not only is this Minnesota, but we've done a lot of wonderful things in terms of hockey. The Wild, is up there kind of at the top, but they have built part of their reputation because they've supported hockey from the ground up. And we've got the biggest youth hockey program in any state in the union. We were the first ones to have girls hockey, first ones to have a girls hockey tournament. Sports Illustrated has made the boys high school tournament the tournament of the year a number of years ago, and they've never been unseated. And this last year, they named, a few months ago, they named St. Paul Hockey Town USA, just for all of those kinds of reasons. So hockey is Minnesota, and I think that it should be the state sport. And if you looked at that little Brandon, his mother told me that he wants to be a sports announcer. So if I haven't convinced you yet, I think that wouldn't that look great on his resume to be at age 11 to have been influential in getting hockey named the state sport in Minnesota?
So, Senator Olson.
So I would encourage your support.
Senator Olson, would you be open for a friendly amendment?
No, it depends on.
I was just thinking if we could insert right on the front, right before ice, if you could insert outdoor ice hockey. Think of all the money that the school districts could save across the state. We had an outdoor tournament up at Bedette and on the river. And so But, you know, really being Minnesota tough, you know.
Mr. Chairman, I think this is all-encompassing, but it was interesting that both of these, in their statement before the committee, said we have 10,000 lakes, and that's an automatic 10,000 hockey arenas that we've got across the state.
Senator Saxhug.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Olson, you did have Senator Thomasoni on your bill.
He was the first one I went to, and I didn't even know how much hockey was in his life. I went and asked him to be the first author before I dropped it in, because I said, where is the Hockey Hall of Fame? Whose district is it in? Well, it's in his district. And then I find out after when he's the answer to an almanac question that he played in the Olympics for Italy, and I thought, wait a minute. So I went to apologize him the first day of session this year that I didn't know that, then find out he was a star high school player, got a full scholarship through college with hockey, and played 17 years professionally for Italy. And so hockey's been an important part of his life. And so it's been fun working with him, because he's plotting. He wants to get this passed too, as does Senator Wieger and Senator Metzen and Senator Ingebrigtsen. We didn't have room for Senator Pappas, but she wanted on too. So,
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I just have to comment on your idea, because remember last winter, it's still, I guess, a month or so ago, when we had that really cold weekend, it was well below, you know, 20 below zero, 15 below zero, and there were pond hockey tournaments in Minneapolis with grown-up adults playing hockey, and apparently that made the national news. I had relatives out east calling me and telling me, and I said, well, guess what? My 8-year-old was playing hockey outdoors at a tournament all weekend, and I was standing there watching him, and we were really mad that they weren't on the news, these children who were playing hockey. That's what really defines Minnesota to me. So I'm with you.
All right. On Senator Olson's motion, I see Chuck or Senator Wieger nodding his head. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Senator, I think Senator Wiergen, and then we'll get to.
Mr. Chair, I have a very simple oral amendment.
Okay, Senator Wiergen.
On page 88, line 18.
Excuse me, what page?
88, line 18.
Senator Wiergen.
Mr. Chair, I just would like to move that we delete the word all at the beginning of the line, because what that would do by having all in there could mean even private early education situations. And so I don't think that's what's intended. I think it's intended to be the public education situations. And so...
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Wiergen, I believe that in committee we actually did delete all. So that was an oversight and would support that.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair.
Part.
And I actually have an amendment on this part. I mean, okay. I know that's a clarification, but we actually were going to remove the office and do something
right.
A little different.
So we'll get to your amendment in a minute.
We'll take care of that.
You want to
Mr. Chair, I can withdraw my amendment.
Senator Wiergen withdraws her motion. Senator Hahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I had an amendment that dealt with this section as well, and maybe if Senator Clark has one, maybe we ought to take a look at them both. But mine is the A33 amendment, and it was.
Why don't we let's Senator Brown, you're next, and then we'll come back to Senator Clark.
Mr. Chair and members, this is a very small amendment. I move the A42 amendment.
A42 amendment.
This is on page 34 of the bill. This is a provision that Senator Ress put forward that established the use of an environmentally sensitive cleaning and maintenance products, a task force in schools to make sure that we were using products that were environmentally friendly. And inadvertently, when she put forward who was going to be on the task force, the very people who use the products were left off, and so this amendment inserts that a school janitor appointed by the commissioner is added to the task force.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I understand there might be a better word, but
someone mentioned custodial engineer.
Sanitary engineer.
I don't know. I know in your committee, I did get into part of the discussion on this one, and I actually felt very sympathetic and sided with Senator Jungbauer, who said he's got 2 to 3 hour speech on the floor on this whole provision. And I don't really know if we need to put all this stuff in legislation about mandates to school districts that actually mandates are costly. And we're at a point where we're not going to be able to offer the districts money. In fact, we're trying to balance the budget. So I know the energy that all of you have and all of our colleagues have in trying to do good things, but this maybe isn't the best year to
Mr. Chairman?
Be doing that. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, we sometimes forget about markets, and markets do work, and I think that, you know, when people have a conscience of that, and I think more and more do in concern for their environment, and products are available, they acquire them. I think we're going to get into a flap. We saw a little bit of it on this fluorescent light bulbs, that there are complications with them, and yet more and more people just buy naturally. We're acquiring them to use it. Why not let those things take their place? Because there's some applications that are really almost impossible. And I mean, that could be true with products. Right. There's sometimes you need certain products to get a job done and you have to do it. But other times, if you can get an environmentally friendly one, you're going to do it. So I would concur that I hope we don't go overboard in having to mandate, because I think as people we're moving that way in our own decisions.
Mr. Chair,
I mean, spoken from one who washes her plastic bags and reuses them.
Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, notwithstanding whether how we end up on the task force issue with regard to the whole bill. This is just making sure that if we do have a task force, that the very people who are the ones that use the products ought to have a seat at the table. So I'm not waging into the philosophical.
All right. Let's on Senator Bonhoff's motion to add.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ress, the author of this provision, supports that.
Okay.
She wanted.
Whether it's a janitor or custodian. I'm not sure what the technical one. Maybe Senate Counsel can find out. But on Senator Bonhoff's motion,
member of custodial staff.
I guess we may have to come back to this thing. I don't know what the cost is on that task force. I know there's a cost, isn't there?
Mr. Chairman, I would expect to see one. We've inundated the department with a number of fiscal note requests, and this is one that I think is okay. Not yet completed.
All right. On Senator Bonhoff's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Who was next? Oh, Senator Clark, I'm sorry.
I have the A39, Mr. Chair.
The A39 amendment.
Members, the provision, there's a couple of pieces that are in here. The Office of Early Learning, and then there's an advisory board. And many of you belong, so we have 146 members of the Early Childhood Caucus. It's bipartisan. Senator Roebling has been one of the caucus leaders. I still think she is one, even if she did retire. We have been working on things together that we think we can move forward that won't really create a fiscal impact this year, or at least not much of one, that can keep us moving forward. Thinking about Senator Torres Ray's work on closing the achievement gap, some of the other work that's been being done. And At the same time, and Senator Hahn had brought up some very good questions that I agreed with when we were in the policy committee, one of the things that's happened in a number of states is that they've created an Office of Early Learning just to bring together the different services and the people who work on early childhood services. And we think that this could be a very good thing for our state to do. It is also something that, frankly, the governor could choose to do. And so where we're at right now, because we're trying to figure out what the right balance of saying, look, we want to make sure something good happens, but not doing a work plan. At this point, we don't think this is quite ready for prime time. So the amendment deletes the Office of Early Learning. Senator Michelle and I met with Matt Kramer yesterday, along both to update but to also say, look, we'd like to work with the governor and the governor's office over the interim about some ideas about how we might be able to move forward. Frankly, there's a little turf stuff going on, too, about some of this. So we just want to take a step back. Now, the other piece that we had had in here that is on page 92 is a state advisory board on school readiness. What this amendment basically does is delete much of what is there, change the name to early learning, because school readiness, frankly, gets confused with our school readiness funding, and it's different than that. And we had already brought forward essentially a 12-member advisory board, but had inadvertently forgotten about legislators. And so what the amendment does is basically say that this group, which would probably not meet very often, would probably meet just a few times or maybe a couple times. We had a summit a couple years ago that the governor had brought people together on. Could be the same kind of thing. Basically, to be looking at the most efficient and effective ways to leverage state and local federal dollars, for early childhood and child care programs, look at the feasibility of coordinating or co-locating, creating an office, and also reviewing the work that the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation recommendations are that will be coming up later on this year. So that is essentially what it does. So it's very modest, but should help us keep moving forward in a positive way.
Okay. Senator Hahn.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And Senator Clark, I appreciate your – I did have another amendment that I think I'll set aside because I think yours is a better amendment than what I was offering. But maybe offering what I hope will be a friendly amendment to your amendment is, in addition to deleting Section 1 that you've done on page 88, Section 2, which is very brief on page 89, that deals with school readiness goal, and I think that that may need to be taken out as well if we're not going to deal with school readiness as an issue. And I, frankly, am a little bit troubled by the statute, the language that calls us to ensure that certain things will occur. And so I'm just asking if that would be something you'd consider adding to your amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Clark.
And Senator Hahn, I would, because what we've been grappling with, how do we move forward in this way without putting goals in statute? And what we're working on right now is hopefully a joint resolution that could give some legislative intent and our broad desires without putting it in statute. But I think that many believe that this is something that could be achievable if we really focus our energies next year about what strategies we work. So, Senator Hahn, I would consider that to be a friendly amendment.
Mr. Chair. Okay,
all right. Senator Bonha.
Senator Hahn, that was my provision in my bill, and I support that, too.
Okay. Any other discussion on this? If not, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted.
Mr. Chairman, I have A40.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I have an A40 amendment, I think, having to do with special ed.
Excuse me, Senator Scheid. Senator Clark's amendment needs to be include page 89, delete section 2. That needs to be included, section 2. So, Senator Clark, that has to be... Wait.
Also, just Mr. Chair, okay. So we've moved on that amendment.
All right.
Amendment to the amendment.
The amendment, Senator Clark, moves to reconsider, whereby the amendment, the A39 amendment, was adopted. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Senator Clark now moves the A39 amendment with the addition of Section 2 on page 89, deleting Section 2 on page 89. Okay? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. All right, Senator Schein.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. The A40 amendment, please. It extends.
Senator Scheid moves the A40 amendment. That's found on page 77. Okay. Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, it. Line 7. So it has to. It's not changing language in the bill, it's just adding a section that has to do with the task force on special education. Excuse me. And I had put in a bill, but I think this does a better job. It's more positive in its approach to the guidance that the task force could use. Instead of saying what we shouldn't be doing, they can be looking toward what we should. And you can see that it changes a Department of Education member of the task force to a parent advocate and says the Department of Education would provide technical assistance. But I think it's important. I recall when I first came to the Senate, Senator Martha Robertson was working on looked at all of the special ed requirements and did a massive undertaking that took, I think, more than a year, certainly to complete. And I don't think we've done anything significant since then. We should be looking at. We should continue to be reexamining. So this would keep that task force going. As you can see, it would go extended for another year. Maybe Senator Weger could respond.
Mr. Chair, excellent amendment.
Okay, would Ms. Schwab, you served on that task force, I believe. Do you have any comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Grace Schwab with the Minnesota School Boards Association. And, yes, Mr. Chairman, I did serve on this. Oftentimes, advocates as well as school people can feel adversarial at times. And I think Senator Scheid's approach is a little bit softer, is to come to consensus and go forward. I just think it's a much better way to go with kids involved, that we should be looking at where we go together instead of where we fall apart.
Did you get the work done?
Is the change in the extending of the time from February 15th, 2008 to 2009, is that something that's needed? We've passed 2008.
Mr. Chairman, if we wanted to keep going. Yes.
Ms. Schwab.
Mr. Chairman and members, this was a very difficult committee to sit on. We met 7 times and worked all through it, and it's not easy work. And by adding the adverse and deprivation procedures, it's going to be even more difficult to do. So I can't tell you as far as time. I know this time through, though, we did feel really rushed and pushed and hurried, so we gave you an incomplete report.
All right. Thank you. On Senator Scheid's motion, all those in – is there anyone else that wants to testify on this? Okay. On Senator Scheid's motion, the A40 amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. The motion is adopted. Any other amendments? Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have an oral amendment, if I could, please. Starting on page 14, line 2.20. Mr. Chair, my motion would be to delete Article 2, Section 2, which begins on page 14, line 20, and goes through 16, line 2, and Article 2, Section 57, which is 63.17 and 64.11. Mr. Chair, what this does is take out the section for world-class schools vision and mission statements. Not that there's anything horribly wrong with what's stated in them, simply that in law they actually don't work. They can't be implemented in that manner, and we're not in the custom or habit of putting vision and mission statements in law. And so it makes it really cumbersome. I think a school district reading this law really wouldn't have a clue what to do about it, because it becomes hugely encompassing what would be expected of them. You can look even just at the very first one, and it says in the area of early learning on 15.19, to ensure the investment in education starts early. How early? What investment? How much investment? And it just goes on from there. There are so many statements that are expected of a school that I don't think they would have a clue what to do about them. And so it simply removes the vision and mission of the world-class schools, and it removes the working group to deal with that vision and mission. And again, it's not bashing what's said here. It's saying that this probably is not appropriate to put in statute.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, we just got done taking out a statement on page, relative to the ensuring that 75% of Minnesota children are school-ready. I think that that was what I had noted when we first went through this bill. Every statement of that is that word ensure, and that has ramifications. Mm-hmm. It's just a goal that I think we better think twice about putting in statute.
And Mr. Chair, I want to apologize for not having it in writing. I'm woefully unprepared for this committee. I got called away from here this morning and had to be gone, and I have to leave again shortly, and I'm kind of doing this. What I had intended to have written is not, so I apologize.
Okay, well, I think I can't remember where we had a little discussion on that, I think the discussion centered around putting language in the statute for things like purpose clauses and visions and goals and things like that, and why, I can understand why at times we would like to do that, but I think when I was serving with Senator Merriam, he was meticulous in never allowing a purpose clause or anything that was other than, spelling out what should be in law. And I think that is a good thing. Even though this is such a kind of a high goal and ideal to try to achieve, we really don't have a place in the statute for stuff like that. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in there already, purpose statements and goals, but I'm not sure we need to add more.
Mr. Chair.
So I kind of understand where you're at, but yet I also appreciate how do you drive change and what kind of where would you like to go, Senator Saltzman?
On this same sort of subject, Mr. Chair, we've dealt with Senator Anderson's bill with how we deal with the cap and trade, and some of her pieces that were originally in legislation. There's discussion about a resolution. And so I need to have something so that there is something on record of the importance of this as a vision for Minnesota, but not to lose it if members feel that it shouldn't be in statute. How do we put this forward as perhaps a guiding principle? Or because I know there's been a lot of work done, and Senator Rumble, I really commend you for carrying this because it's a very important statement. But doing something like that, I just put that out as maybe a way to make sure that this is not lost.
Okay. Senator Rummel, and then we'll move on here.
I appreciate, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the comments. The motivation that brought this to the table was the impetus to capture in a way a plan toward which we would focus, or that would help us focus our work as we want to improve student achievement, that the state of Massachusetts put in statute a plan. So as I understand it, the vision statement is more of a plan setting forward priorities. I'm sensitive to the comment about the word ensure. I think that is a difficult word. And we could probably substitute the word pursue from line 15:17. But if we don't decide where we're going, we're never going to get there. And what I've, you know, and I know I'm new here, I do think that we do a lot of Band-Aid work instead of setting a direction. And I don't see this as goals. I see this as a plan to pick off two or three of these. And we had a hearing here in your own committee about the plan and the collaboration of numerous organizations who have come to a consensus that these are key elements that is going to get Minnesota where it needs to be. So I would argue to keep it. I guess that's enough said.
Okay. Senator Culp?
Well, Mr. Chair, and just quickly, and I really appreciate where you're going with this, Senator Rubble. I thought about you this weekend because I watched a documentary from Michael Palin. It's a travel log. He's traveling around Eastern Europe, and he went to the country of Transnieper, which I never knew existed. It is on the eastern bank of the Dnieper River. It is actually a part of Moldova, but they have their own standing army. They have their own government, and yet no country in the world recognizes the poor Transnieperese. And I am not making this up. But then I was struck by the line in your vision statement that says that all cultures are included and supported. And I thought, really, about the impossibility of that. And now my daughter knows about the Transnieperese, but probably to have schools include that would be, and not to make light. I think that it kind of goes to Senator Worgen's point. I understand where you're going. I understand where everyone's going, but I think there's some very broad statements in here where we might run into a little trouble having it in legislation. Oh,
Senator Worgen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Chair, I want to assure Senator Rummel, I'm not trying to belittle her goal. That's not the purpose of what I'm doing at all.
I definitely agree. I think the difficulty our committee faces, and I think this happens many times, is how do we put language in statute? Because once we leave here, other people have to read that language and then interpret it. And sometimes,
it's lawyers.
Yeah, it's not us. I mean, we kind of get an idea where we'd like to go, but then, you know, after we leave, somebody has to follow up. I don't think we really have a solution. What Senator Rummel is talking about is very true. I mean, we need to have. If we're going to have top quality education, we need to have some kind of goals, something to shoot for, and whether it's a plan or whether it's how it's spelled out, I think is a difficult thing. Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, there's probably just a couple of us that recall Senator Pogemiller's chairmanship of the committee and how he posted, he had a couple different charts. There was the A list, the B list, the C list. These pieces of vision remind me of something that could be put up, and we could match our bills up to these goals. I mean, if we wanted to establish committee goals, and how you are showing that you're having rigorous pathways to academic rigor, and if you're involving the community or including cultures and how your bill does that, I think, but I don't think it belongs in the statute, probably.
You know, I think, and I just kind of toss this out to anyone, this is a challenge. Almost any business, no matter how small or how large, has to have, you know, 5-year goals, 10-year goals. It has to have some kind of a plan as to where they want to go. And so there is a purpose for what we're addressing or trying to address. I think Senator Wieger, you realize too that this is I don't think there isn't direct state cost in this, but it, I think the concern some people had is that certain individual words could give a liability to school districts that would be more unintended than anything. And we're getting right down to the wire where we're going to have to do something and have a bill in finance on by Thursday night, so, or Friday morning. I guess I'm open for suggestions. But Senator Wirgin's motion, you mean, yeah. And your motion is to delete it, to those two sections, okay.
Yes.
All right, any other discussion, Senator Wieger?
Very briefly, Mr. Chair, I respectfully oppose the amendment. This is a vision statement. I don't see us being held legally responsible to the extent each part of the vision can't be accomplished. It's a roadmap. It's telling us where we're going. If you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. A lot of people put a great deal of effort in this through Minnesota Promise, and this respects that. Future legislatures should also examine what that vision would be for them.
Are both, Senator Wirgin, are both pieces of tied together? If the first part of your amendment is lost, would Section 57 stand on its own?
Mr. Chair, Section 57 is the working group
to carry out Section 2.
That's correct.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair.
Section 57?
Where is that?
Is there a cost on Section 57?
63.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Wirgin?
Section 57 starts on 63, line 17.
Right. I think that section for sure is carrying a cost.
Yes, it does.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, task forces tend to carry a fiscal impact. I would anticipate that this would generate a cost.
Okay. Okay. Well, members, I would just renew my concern about the tightness of the budget, and I don't know exactly what we don't have a fiscal note per se on that, but I'm guessing that they come. Usually, these task forces come in around 100,000 or more. So,
Mr. Chairman, are you suggesting dividing the amendment for now?
I would like to vote on the first part, the Section 2 first, and if that stays in, then that could stay in without Section 57.
Well, Mr. Chair, out of respect for your opinion, I will certainly divide my amendment if that's what you'd like. So then I would offer to remove Article 2, Section 2, page 14, line 20 through 16, line 2, which is the vision and mission statement. And, Mr. Chair, I don't want to prolong the discussion, but when I read each of these objectives, and there are 10 of them, and if they're in law, school districts are really going to well, they have to abide by law. And how is a school district going to ensure some of these things or even calculate the cost or begin to implement them? I think it will be an enormous cost to local districts to try, initially, to try and implement all of these things because they will be in law. And again, it's not a lack of respect for the work or anything in it.
But Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Senator Wergen, the root of that on line 17 is that the legislature should pursue the policies and school finance reforms based on the following goals. So, you know, I think that the local schools are capable of ignoring that or reminding us that we have been.
Well, okay, Senator Wergen.
Mr. Chair, I don't think that they would look at that.
Keep this.
Okay, it says the legislature, but it still is a message to the schools that this is what's going to be pursued, and I think it does build expectations of the school districts, but even if it's a legislature, it's still a vision and mission statement, and Senator Betzold is one that I've watched in every committee taking these things out of bills as well, so I suspect it's not over.
Okay, Senator
Mr. Chairman, I was just
Olson.
Reflecting on this. Senator Saltzman and I, we will probably be proposing on line 29 that educators use data and research to improve teaching and learning every day. We'll probably have to have some data police there to monitor the schools to see that they're doing that.
Senator,
there's some work that needs to be done, I think. I know there was a lot of good work that went in that, but even before it would ultimately get in law, if we leave that in, I think we ought to look at how we have what some of the wording does in fact mean and what it might mean to legislative reading.
Senator Rummel.
Mr. Chair, first of all, I'm not clear on the amendment because lines 14-21 through 15-14 are already in statute.
Right.
You just don't change it.
Yeah, it would just relate to the new language.
Just sub 2.
And
thank you.
Just take it out. Mr. Chairman, you need to delete section 2 so that you go back to the original language for what remains if it in fact passes. It doesn't take the current law out if you delete section 2. It lets it stand as it is. It wouldn't add the new language, but you'd need to do all of section 2 because you're adding vision, which was not a part of the original law.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, do you think
Senator Rummel?
Do you think I could talk to some members about this afterward, between now and this evening, or whenever we come back? I'm unclear what the amendment is. I'm sensitive to many of the comments about the words "all" or the words "ensure."
You can talk to Senator Wergen. She has the motion.
Yeah. So I would like to.
Senator Wergen, do you want to withdraw your motion? We have many more amendments that we're dealing with here. So,
Mr. Chair, I'll withdraw my motion.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, are you going to pursue the Section 57? That is a working.
No. Well, that one has a cost either way.
So why don't we move to delete that?
All right. Senator Wergen moves to delete Section 57. That's the working group. And all right. All those in favor say on deleting Section 57. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, the same sign.
No.
Motion.
No.
Motion is adopted. Let's see. I'm trying to figure out who is next on amendments. Senator Dahl?
The A24 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dahl moves the A24 amendment.
And, Mr. Chair, page 29 is the language.
Yeah. Members, I'd like to continue and try to get through these amendments so that we can allow staff a chance to sort out what's in, what's out, and so that they can have a little bit of time. If that's all right with you, we do have this room for a little while longer. Okay, Senator Dahl.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, this just want to add a sentence, basically, that we're talking about growth-based value-added system here. And when we get to this section here, basically, when we're talking about teacher teams, sometimes a teacher team is one teacher. And when I consider my own school district, the facts teacher, the family and consumer science teacher, she's pretty much a team of one. So when we're talking about compiling test results at the teacher team level or a grade level, I believe that might be a little too I don't know. I don't want to connect that just to one person. I want to make sure that the team would include at least three teachers, and that would be the language that would be added. So as the amendment says on page 29, line 24, just add, the commissioner must not compile test results at the teacher team level or grade level unless at least three teachers are included.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, Senator Roblin.
Thank you. There is quite a few school districts that wouldn't have three teachers at a grade level in the same building, and so I don't know that this is going to work. It would work for larger districts, but it certainly isn't going to work for smaller ones or even building by building sometimes, which I think might be appropriate to have some results from.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
I need a clarification, because for all student categories with a cell size of at least 20, so if you had 20 was your cell size, you probably would only have a single teacher or teachers that would work with them. So I say that in relation to the last sentence. Is the last sentence meaning that it isn't just on the small class level, but you have to be able to make composite to show that student growth at levels that involve a team of teachers or a grade level or a school? It's kind of a continuing order of magnitude, beginning with the individual, which would then not make the amendment not necessary, but maybe the clarification should be the student growth at the individual class level as well as the teacher team level, grade level. Maybe that's the clarification that's needed so that it would address the concern that Senator Dahl raises.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, Dr. Heisted is here, and he could probably explain what that means better than I could.
Mr. Chair and Senators, the growth model that is proposed, my name is David Heisted. I'm Executive Director for Research Evaluation Assessment for Minneapolis Public Schools. A team of experts in the state assessment and research from the Minnesota Assessment Group and I put together the proposed growth model, and we felt that a minimum cell size of 20 was necessary for the results to be statistically robust. It could be two classrooms combined that would create 20 students. It is possible that you would have only one classroom at 20 students, but if you had lower than that class size, the statistical dependability would be jeopardized. In terms of teacher teams, we're talking about reading and mathematics test scores currently, where we have test scores every year. This would include the special ed teacher, the Title I teacher, the English language learner teacher. In many cases, there are teams that are working together. We explicitly wanted to leave it at the teacher team level rather than bring it down to the individual teacher level. We thought that it was appropriate to reinforce the collaborative nature of most of the work taking place in our reading and math teams.
Members, how many more members have amendments?
I have okay. One other one.
Okay, so there's a few of them. I believe your caucus has a caucus meeting at 11:45.
Yeah.
Yes. And
we're torn right now.
Yeah. when can we meet?
6 o'clock.
But I thought we had another meeting at 6.
We have 5:30
tonight. Okay. All right. So we will have to recess until 6 o'clock tonight. Because this room is being used by other committees. And
so you'll meet with us before or after?
After. I don't know what we got here. So
save all this.
So members, if you can gather up your papers. And
so I assume we're going to bring this up.
I'm saving everything I need.
Is there a possible?
All right. I think members, we will recess until 6 o'clock tonight here in this room, and then after that we have to. So there's a lot of work to be done, and we're also running into time constraints in processing papers and amendments, because once we get done, then the staff has to start working. So, all right, recessed until 6.